We're here to take over School Facilities Commission. Ken, you've got the floor. Everybody get their handouts? Yep.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman.
Go ahead. I think, Ken, I mean, we want to know what the Select Committee recommendation is, the governor's rec, and then we have more money, and if we wanted to build more, what would be our capacity?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I met you 4 years ago, pretty close to today, and went through this process with Mr. Shiveler. At the time, you were working on a supplemental budget to deal with inflation. We couldn't keep up with the rising cost of construction. 4 years later, we're in a bit different place. And then I was also given a charge, a to-do list, if you like, by the governor, by the commissioners. It was reiterated by the Senate Education Committee that had my confirmation hearing. And I'm here to report today that that initial task, the to-do list, is by and large completed. And you'll see the results here in the next few pages in your handout. Over the last few years, and I've now put in place and is fully functional, came up with a whole array of design guidelines, from per child footprint type guidelines that Senator Peterson and I were just talking about, to quality of construction issues, furniture, fixtures and equipment, technology stuff, everything. We came up with a process to prioritize our buildings across the state, so we spend less time arguing about what to do next and more time on what and how to do things. It's very much data-driven, and it includes those assessments. And I have to tell you, we've been to a couple of national gatherings of people that do similar things. These are typically done by school districts. I'm not aware of any other state that does it quite the way we do. And the process we have in place is very much the envy of these folks. They thought they had discovered something great when they found out about MGT. So they're several years behind us. We came up with a procurement process that addressed issues of in-state, out-of-state, service providers. Along with that went all the documents. We developed Wyoming's own set of documents as opposed to the generic AIA documents. We went through a conversion of our accounting system to make it more transparent, a more accessible database. Developed a new website, again, for transparency and access to information and so on. And you know it's working well when the contractors come to this database to gather information about themselves, to report to their clients and so forth. And it also reminds me of a comment you made, Senator Nicholas, a couple of years ago, that you would like us to get to a point where if you wanted to know about, I think you used doorknobs in some building, that you can drill down and get that information. In fact, you can do that. You can look at doors or doorknobs across the state, particular district, right down to a particular building, and pull up a copy of the invoice that references the work. And as daunting a task as that may have appeared to be, at least initially, by far the more complicated aspect of this job was trying to make the school construction relevant to the function within, the instruction, and to the extent possible, influence it. I've heard the comments that buildings don't teach anybody anything, and that's absolutely true. But trust me, if you talk to folks that are working out there, buildings can get in the way of instruction, and they can get out of the way of instruction and help facilitate the activity. It makes some difference, not to mention the sort of the intangible how people feel about their place of work or where they go to learn every day. It does, in fact, have an impact. And all of this work was done collaboratively with the Wyoming architects through the Wyoming chapter of AIA, with both construction contractor and general contractor associations, and our school districts. And, you know, again, you know things are working well when we had controversy, which we did routinely, the commission meetings would be packed with people. Now I struggle to get folks to come. At our last couple of meetings, we've had one or two people who aren't related somehow to the commission to show up. And I hope that is a sign of contentment and not that folks have just quit caring. All right, so with that, if we turn to page one, I'll run through these. You're looking at the first several documents are what we produce every month now for the Select Committee and our commissioners and the governor's office, and they summarize. They are the equivalent of monthly financial statements for a business, but prepared to display and sort of lay out the finances of a public entity. So this first page is the overall picture of what you've appropriated over the years, how it peaked and it has declined the last couple of bienniums. You see the numbers next to it. The different shades in those bars are capital construction, major maintenance, and operations, the three primary categories of funding. Page two, we take those three things and look at them more closely, refers to our operations. This agency went beyond the governor's 10%. We eliminated positions. We eliminated operational monies, and you can see the trend is downward. It is much leaner, if you like, than when we first started. And this coincides with the level of activity, deployment of dollars, that really took off in the last 3 or 4 years. So when I arrived here 4 years ago, this agency had deployed about a little over $200 million and had $700 million in the bank. Today, in the next 4 years, we've deployed nearly $1 billion. And we have, you'll see, maybe a couple of $100 million still in the bank. Contracted or about to be contracted. We'll talk more about that. So that's the operations. The next page is the major maintenance piece of our budget. You know, I can tell you both the Select Committee and the governor, former governor, and our commissioners have expressed concern about major maintenance in that the districts weren't deploying as much as they were being appropriated for major maintenance. It was a trend that we've been working very hard at reversing. And we get the final who spent how much on what report from the districts once a year. It arrives after the end of the fiscal year in June. And for the first time, that expenditure exceeded the appropriation by a significant amount, as you can see. The fiscal year 9-10 biennium. This is a trend we've been looking for and are still working hard at maintaining. This will go a long way in bringing down the balances out in the districts and getting the maintenance work that's needed done. Okay. Page four is the capital construction detail. And if, with your permission, Ms. Chairman, I'd like to spend a few minutes here. If you, and we'll bounce back and forth between page four and what's numbered 4A. 2 years ago, three years ago, we talked about when I first arrived here, we had more money to appropriate for capital construction than we had capacity to spend. And it was affecting the inflation rate, all sorts of issues, attracted a disproportionate amount of interest from out-of-state folks to come in here because the money was here. And it drove up our costs and caused some problems. Then the subsequent biennium, we were asked to sort of come up with a number that if Now our capacity exceeds our ability to fund. So what's the right amount to fund? And I went through, it was in our annual report, and we talked about this, through a process of ascertaining that if, as an entity, we own 22.3 million square feet of real property, there's a certain amount of investment necessary to maintain it and recapitalize it. Surely we're not the only people in this business. Is there a model out there? What do other people do? And indeed there is. You know, you have private entities, the Pizza Huts and Walmarts of the world that manage many more square feet than we do. And then you have university systems, large school districts, and federal government that also manage and have to maintain real property. So we put a model together, and it made a recommendation. Well, this was last budget session. We didn't have the money to go there. So I've tried a different angle here, a simpler approach, if you like, to trying to sort of explain this. So when we talk about levels of funding for capital construction, of course, it can be zero and remain zero forever if we get out of the business of building and maintaining schools. If that can somehow be delegate outsourced, if you like, we wouldn't have to worry about it. But so long as you're in that business, how do you figure out how much and what to do? So page 4A, and this started with a very simple analogy, that if I'm in the trucking business and I own a fleet of trucks and I want to stay in the trucking business, these trucks have a certain life. Besides maintaining them, tires, parts, and so forth, occasionally, when they reach their useful life, I have to replace them. In private business, we take a depreciation on that truck, save the money, buy the next truck with it. Right? Very simple concept. Surely something like that exists with buildings. Well, it does, except instead of, say, 6-year life, they have a 60-year life. So we started with that, and we said if we own 323 buildings, and they have an average life expectancy of 60 years, then can we use that analogy and go through an analysis? So first thing we did was sort of see what kind of age distribution our buildings, school buildings, have in the state. So those 323 buildings, you can see on top of the page, I've got them in 10-year increments, right? 0 to 10, 10 to 11, 20, and so forth. Fairly evenly distributed, right? So intuitively, if I own 300-some-odd buildings and they have a 60-year life, I would think that you would be replacing about 5 of them a year if they were built sort of evenly over that period of time. Now, some of our buildings clearly have a longer life expectancy than 60, and unfortunately some, the 50s construction was not great, 80s construction was not great. There's some that have a lower life expectancy. It's just, that's just, you know, with times and circumstances dictated what they could do. And our districts, remember, were building with bonds. They would pass a bond and build what they could with the money they got. So they were all over the board with standards of construction. That dictates longevity. So there's generally a correlation between age and need, if you like. Okay, it's a real simple way of looking at it, but there is that correlation. So then the average age of that square footage happens to be about 33, 34 years. Now, for a building to make it to 60, along the way, about halfway through that life, so about 33, that you would hope your average to be around 30, you have to do a major upgrade. The mechanical systems don't live 60 years, right? So there are parts and major parts and parcels of the building that you have to replace and maintain. So we went through this little analysis. The total square footage that we own as a state is 22.3 million square feet. Now, interestingly enough, if we were to replace all of that tomorrow by our own guidelines, it would be just under 16 million square feet. Okay? Most of that excess square footage is in our secondary schools. And again, remember, our buildings were built with local bond monies, and they often had a community component. You know, folks were passing a bond, they choose to have a rec center attached or a larger sort of a commons space that doubled as town you know, space. They did that. So, and it was also, you know, our student population is lower than it's been. And we've, the select committee has seen this data, but we're building buildings for more students than we have today. So they're larger. Some of them have excess space because populations have declined. Although we're on a rebound statewide on that issue. 323 schools, life expectancy. So per biennium, then, intuitively, you're replacing 10.77 schools every biennium. Okay. Now, the average square feet per new building is 48,900. If it's a new building and we're replacing it and we can design well and use our guidelines, that number, if you take the average of the existing square feet, it's 69,000 feet. Okay, and that's important only because some of the remodels cost less, but they're of generally of a larger square footage. New construction costs more, but it's generally smaller footprint. Okay, the all-inclusive average cost new construction today, this is 2010, prior to getting our bids here in the next few weeks, is $208.80. That same number for renovation is about $156. So the total square feet of new construction expected per biennium, if you follow a model like this, is about 526,000 square feet of new construction, 740,000 feet of renovation. And then, of course, there's inflation associated with this. Our historical page 4B is the backup data for this. Rate of inflation is 2.55%. The economists that helped us with forecasting suggested 3% per year going forward once the economy turns and cost of construction begins to come up. Then, of course, then I was asked, that's all great with existing buildings and so forth, but what about the increase in population? Well, the rate of increase since 2005, that's when the trend hit bottom and began to increase. Overall, K-12 system, it's been increasing about 0.87%. But most of the growth has been in the K-6 population, and the growth there has been a little bit higher. It's 1.1%. So assuming that majority of our excess capacities in our secondary schools, we're making the assumption that they can generally absorb that growth in the secondary grades. But 455 new kids in the state are going to need some place to sit in the elementary schools where that's not where the excess capacity is typically, right? So that's another 60,000 feet of new construction. You add all that up, and it says that if with our current rate of growth in population and with the age and distribution of our buildings, we're looking at about $250 million per biennium to recapitalize our buildings. Recapitalization is a very real thing. It's there. You have to do it unless you want to get out of school building business. Now, this would be true for state buildings, university buildings. It doesn't matter. If you own real property, this is you're sort of obligated to do this. And that, going back to page 4, represents that black dot on that graph. And then when you talk about forecasting our investment going forward, it's that line. And that the slope of that line is that 2.55% historic inflation rate. Now, from year to year or biennium to biennium, it can vary, right? So last year the economy was such that the bids were lower. A couple of years earlier they were higher. But look at it over sort of a macro look. That's what it looks like. Okay? And I would argue that as a public entity, we would do well to hover around this line. When we defer maintenance or defer recapitalization, that's all you're doing. You're not eliminating it. You're deferring it. So if we do less one year, please rest assured at some point in the future, you're going to have to play catch-up. So the last three bienniums, you see those bars going above the line? Those are very expensive dollars. Okay? And they occur when you go below the line for an extended period of time. Right? All right, I won't bore you with that. Page 5 is sort of the current status of capital construction dollars. The top table there is a repeat of what's been appropriated by biennium. The bottom part of that, this is a monthly report that we also provide to the select committee and to our commissioners. They talk about, it sort of displays the monthly activity. So projects go from a budget to a contract. And the key number to focus on here is in column C in the lower table, in bold, third number from the top in that column is $2,715,691. That figure represents our current unobligated balance. These are dollars that are not committed to anything, are available to deal with unanticipated events, emergencies, inflation, and so forth. Now, as projects close, monies trickle back. That list is shrinking pretty dramatically because we're closing out. We're sort of getting to the end of the pile, so to speak. We anticipate that over another $1 million-plus dollars to dribble back over the next several months. So we will go into the middle of our biennium with about a $4 million sort of unobligated fund. All movements in and out of that are reported monthly. They're approved by the commission every month and reported to the select committee and the commissioners every month. Okay. Any questions on this graph? Chairman Harshman can speak to this as well. He's used to seeing them now, I think.
Kim, you had a percentage increase, I guess, for construction costs is 2.55.
Yes.
Major maintenance or renovation cost, has that been approximately the same, more or less?
Yes, I would say more or less. They both come from the same pool. Our business has two expenditures, have two general components. There's human labor costs and cost of materials. Cost of materials are determined by forces outside of our region, our control. Cost of human resource is something that fluctuates, and it can fluctuate dramatically. That's where most of the cost savings and cost increases come from, other than, of course, materials. When fuel, for example, hit, diesel was nearly $5. We felt that. Steel, copper, and so forth. But it's a play between those, and the same things, same forces are in play when we're dealing with major maintenance. Okay. Page 6. We've had conversations before with Senator Nicholas and others about shovel-ready projects, this notion of having shovel-ready projects. And this graph, we're trying to address several things. We have three delivery methods at our disposal, and they are design, bid, build, CM, CMA, CMAR, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and design, build. I can tell you after several years of experience that they all have a time and place. They're appropriate occasions to use in every one of them, and it varies. And we actually put together a matrix for coming to that decision, like what factors have to be there for you to choose one over the other. Today, majority of our projects are design, bid, build. The environment is sort of conducive to that. There was a time you put out a project for bid, and we got one, maybe two people show up to bid. So you have to be flexible. Now, they also have implications on timing. The select committee and others sort of made a commitment, I believe it was the last session, if not before, that once we fund a project for design, we have put ourselves on the hook, so to speak. We're committed to that constituency, the district, to see that project through. Okay. Now, because of a number of reasons, it's possible to fund a project for planning and design in one biennium and construction in the next. Okay. Understanding that there's some risk with that. So last biennium, it's possible for that project to slide. That would be at your discretion. You could go to zero funding and postpone the construction phase for a year or longer. But that first pictorial up there is typical of that kind of a scenario. So we can do the planning and design, and we generally have to wait. It takes typically about a year to do the design, a few months prior to that, depending on complexity, do the planning. So we're sitting there waiting for about a half a year for the next opportunity for funding. It may come at the next, not the middle of the biennium supplemental budget, may be the following year, so it may have to wait a year and a half. Okay. There are two types of delivery methods that you can use in that scenario. So when you split the design from construction, design build is no longer an option. Okay. So that goes off the table. It's either design bid build or CMA CMAR. Okay. So the next graph is how a design build project. It's the fastest delivery method from planning. You know, even if you spend the same amount of time deciding what it is you want to do, because the design and construction overlap, it's the quickest way to deploy dollars. There are instances where that's appropriate, and our example would be the Pinedale Elementary School. It's one that was done very successfully with this process. And then, of course, is where we have all the funding together, design and construction. It can occur in a biennium depending on, again, length or complexity of the project. If it's a phased project, if it's a remodel with children in the school, you know, you have no choice but to do it in pieces. It tends to take longer. And those, you know, design, bid, build, and CMAR can be the delivery methods. We can typically, with our schools, in a given biennium, if we have the funding, you know, we can get that project from inception to contract without too much trouble. An elementary school can be completed. Okay? Now, also, think of the cycles, the way our funding works and our construction cycles work. And also think about the general notion of we're building about five schools a year. In a perfect world, that's, you know, where you'd like to be there, five or six schools per year. In order to, and this is how much time, depending on your selected delivery method, how much time it can take to be ready to build, right? So for us to be, quote, shovel ready, say, next spring, we have to have a certain number of projects in queue for design to be able to do that. If not, then the design begins next spring and construction has to wait till the following year. Okay? So, any questions with that? No? Page 7 is a, a quick look at the schools have opened and just sort of to show the amount of work or that has been done in the last couple few years. So the schools that opened last, not this past fall, but the one before, the 2009-10 school year, 11 schools, you see which those are. In fall of 2010, the following 10 schools opened their door. And I think the Rollins Elementary School, they moved in yesterday. Okay, so you can add that to that list. And schools that are currently under construction, five of them, and the Campbell Elementary School at the bottom stack. I think the bids for that are being opened today. We expect the rest of those bids to be opened here in the first half of the year. Okay. Pages 8 and 9 are two reports that we were required to provide to the Select Committee on a monthly basis. This gives a detailed look at those projects that were authorized in the last budget session, how much was appropriated, how those budgets evolved, what contracts were have of those which have been awarded, which contracts have been awarded, and they have begun to be spent. And then the balances. Both for capital construction projects and for what, if you recall, we refer to as component-level projects. Okay. And that brings us to our budget request. So last summer, we were still operating under the scenario where revenues were limited, the funding wasn't there. We were told that little to no supplemental budget for capital construction. We also know the state economists told us that inflation begins to sort of, we will hit bottom middle of this year and expect our costs to increase at 0.25% per month beginning in July. So there was a great deal of interest to expedite to the extent possible the deployment of our dollars, right? Get these projects out the door, not all at once. You know, we didn't want to overwhelm the system, but in successive order as quickly as possible. I can tell you all the projects that you authorized last year and funded, at least partially, and with monies that we were able to save because of the drop in cost of construction, we were able to fund everything that was authorized. Okay, if you recall, there were a couple of projects at the bottom. We actually got to them. It was a pretty good deal. And they are all being bid as we speak in the next few months, most of them in the next few weeks, really. And those contracts will be awarded and will be off and running, which brings me to next spring. Nothing left to bid. Okay. There won't be much projects for bid for construction next spring. Okay. Yes, sir, a year from now. Yes. 2012. Yes. So we were essentially able to deploy the dollars we got in the year, first year of the biennium. Okay. So page 10. Of course, after the summer, the first Craig report, it appeared that the environment was changing, and we were asked by different folks, Select Committee, Appropriations Committee, the Governor's Office. To develop a set of what-if scenarios that go from zero to, and they told us to make a recommendation. I do understand that the new governor's recommendation was possibly as low as zero. It's doable. It does not come without consequences, of course. It simply pushes back construction, but it's doable. And the other end of that spectrum would be the right-hand column at the very bottom. It's $180 million. And I'll explain how we came up with that. With the exception of the last five projects, you're looking at Governor Friedenthal's recommendation of $61.9 million and the projects that were included in that list. It was done to deal with some issues that came up over the year with in various school districts to try and put a dent into abandoned buildings that need to be demolished and to design and get some projects ready for bidding next spring. We added to that those projects that we knew we could have under contract by the end of the biennium. Okay, so if the question was, if you had more money, what and how would you deploy it? It would be these projects. All but one is already under design, and they would all be under contract before the end of the biennium. Now, admittedly, the Natrona County and Kelly Walsh High Schools will be towards the end of the biennium, it'll be about this time next year that they will be put out for bid. They'll be under contract, and they will have started spending money before the end of the biennium and the fiscal year. Okay? So that's where that number came from, and quite frankly, the agency's prepared to work anywhere in that range that you deem appropriate.
Ken, could we go over on page 10, 37, and let's see, the new Dubois School, 39, a little discussion about how those decisions are made, whether it's going to be a new middle school or the solution could be a new 5-6 elementary in Dubois. It could be a new high school or a new K through 12 facility. Kind of the currently what the process is as far as how you work or don't work or who makes that decision. There's been some discussion about where that decision should be made and how it should be made, and I want to have a good understanding about what the process is now.
Very good, Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer. What our process identifies first is simply, we use our needs index and the assessments and so forth to identify the school that needs to be sort of discussed further. Okay, that's the needs index is something different than a project list, right? The project list depends on all those things that you just brought up. So let's take Dubois for an example. Dubois is, there are a number of issues at play. It's one of those few districts in the state that's actually continuing to have a declining enrollment. They have a separate high school and a K-8 building. The high school is the one that's in disrepair, the issues with the soil and foundation and so forth. So the conversations, and you can imagine, unlike state construction, universities and junior colleges, we have this relationship with our school districts that actually hold title to that property and to that building, and they get very emotional about their configurations and how they operate within those buildings, as we found that last year. So it's an interesting dynamic, but this is how we apply the process that we have in place. So that's our planning phase. The first bubble in that cartoon that you saw earlier is that phase. And Dr. Loam here is the gentleman in our office that heads that effort, and I know he will do a better job of explaining it than I. So with your permission, I'll defer to Dr. Loam.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, using Dubois specifically, this is a district, as the director said, is in declining enrollment. It is unlikely, as we visit with the district, that they will ever have a great influx of revenues. So one of the things they're going to have to do is how do we maximize the revenues we have to deliver the services that we need to. The superintendent believes that their enrollment will generally be, for round numbers, let's say it's 15 students a class. He doesn't see that that's ever going to jump up to 30 or 45 per grade level. So he's trying to maximize his resources. His buildings are now split. Obviously, it's in Dubois. So there is a little bit of travel time. There's a little bit of lost time there, lost efficiency. So the question now is where should the schools best be located to maximize the resources? And we work very closely with the districts to figure out a solution to that, and we're currently in that discussion with them now. They are interested in having that discussion. It's obviously one that will impact the community. The community, rightly so, should be involved in that discussion about how should this be done. Should it be a K-12 facility? Should it be the K-8 plus a high school piece to it, knowing how many students they have and how many square feet that would generate? And we'll have that discussion with them, and hopefully that will be reported back by the end of May is their timeline.
And we provide, Mr. Chairman, we provide resources for this effort. And by that, what we mean is we pay for sort of an educational planner to come and help facilitate that conversation and help the superintendent and community to openly and very formally address all their options. when Dr. Loam talks about they have to manage their resources, they get so many dollars for teachers. We were just talking about that. Can you maximize your personnel by having them in one building when the numbers are that small? And there's a bill currently coming through the legislature that sort of sets out some requirements in our planning discussions. You know, we have to look at the great reconfigurations and so forth, but I believe it stops short of mandating intra-district consolidation. So we try to do it through education, through conversation, through financial efficiencies, not from just the building perspective alone necessarily, but through operational savings for the district and come up with the best solution for them. It is possible that in Dubois, at the end of the day, that community digs their heel in and says, absolutely not, we want a separate standalone high school. But then they will also understand that if they do that, they're looking at a 24,000 square foot high school. It's very tiny. So my hope is that in the course of our conversations, they will realize the benefits of co-locating with the K-8, adding on to it, and having the benefits of the scale.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Ken. So at the end of the day, as the current process is that the local district makes that decision. You give them all the information to make that decision with, and all the help you can. Try to guide them as far as where the experts believe might be the best decision. But at the end of the day, the district says one way or the other. Okay. Thank you.
Tee this up a little bit for discussion here. If you took a look at your goldenrod and you look at the, you begin to look at the school CAFCON account, and the school CAFCON account goes down to zero. It goes down to zero because on the line item on the 2010 budget bill, there is a transfer to the Common School Permanent Land Fund holding account. So that's what's profiled at the end of the biennium. Is that right, Bill? Okay. Now you move that over to the school CAFCON hold, or the Common School Permanent Land Fund holding account on the opposite page, and then you have that 489, the 498 profiled there as a transfer in from school CAFCON account. And then if we do nothing, our present bill is scheduled on June 30th, 2012. It will trip $381 million into the Common School Permanent Land Fund. As I pointed out before, those are the types of resources. That's really the source of revenues that we funded Hathaway with. And part of the objective was to, when we have some excess revenues, to build back or build up more aggressively the corpus of the Common School Permanent Land Fund. So if that were to tip, that would be an inviolate fund transfer, and it would be there for future generations. So as we begin to look at the school CAFCON, obviously we have some decisions to make, whether we continue those fund flows as we've got there, whether we want those trips to take place. We got sweeps, and then we've got trips. Now, when you a sweep from one account to another, and then tripping into the Common School Permanent Land Fund. So now, when you take a look at the amount of money that we have available, you compare that to the amount that we had teed up for construction. We can obviously engage in a far more aggressive construction activity if we'd like to do that. So then if you go look at a couple things to compare, is if you look at page 10 of the folder, that the handout you just got from the School Facilities Commission, and compare that to page 8 of your budget. So if you look back to agency 27 budget, you flip over to page 8, and you see that the budget request is we'd already appropriated $152 million. We added in under the GovsRec $61 million. 934-428. So the couple discussions to have here that I want to, one is, should we engage in more construction? On page 10, you see that there are one, two, three, four, five more potential capital constructions that lined up, including three in Natrona County, a Johnson County, and a Fremont County facility with proposed dollars. There are, we'll get in, we need to discuss that to see whether they, whether there's a real probability that if we teed those dollars up, we could get that construction done in a prudent manner. If you look over on your CapCon account, I noticed that the agency requested $10 million for component levels, and the governor only recommended $8 million. We need to talk about that difference. And then, as I understand it, another area for discussion is that when the commission first provided their budget to the select committee, there was a proposal for $14 million worth of major maintenance. And all of that came out. So I assume if you don't do the major maintenance, you're going to push on to components. So we have the $14.7 million of major maintenance, and I don't know that everybody else has that spreadsheet unless we resurrect an older spreadsheet.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
I think another piece of information we're missing, too, is the select committee's recommendations on the budget, which were $32 million, I think. It wasn't the $61 that the governor had, and all these security vestibules and all those kind of things we didn't fund. And there's been some talk about major maintenance. And so I think we have, it's not in any of our things, but I think we have it to hand out right now. Do we? Can we hand that out? I think that.
$32.8 million.
Yeah, there were two new schools. One at, well, actually, one new school in Douglas, and then the combining of phases with the. It was Kemmer, was it not? Kemmer High School was going to be three-phase, and we decided to speed it up to a two-phase.
Ken, you gave this presentation saying that we should be somewhere around $250 million on average. You well exceeded it with your expanded budget here.
Right.
And I'm just wondering why you're going against your own recommendations.
Well, Senator, Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, those projects, as I mentioned, we won't actually be able to deploy the dollars in the biennium. Those projects at the bottom will go under contract towards the very end of the biennium. So you won't have the impact of those dollars on inflation and cost of construction the way you would otherwise. So, you know, it's the question was asked of us, if you had the funds, could you deploy them in this biennium? And the answer is yes. It'll go under contract and begin to be spent before the end of the biennium, but not actually spent. Let's see.
You're done. Okay, let's take a look at handout number 39. So your original recommendation on September of 2010 included major maintenance of $14 million. And it was the anticipated shortfall for fiscal year 2012. What happened to that shortfall?
Mr. Chairman, it's still there. The districts can expect receiving about 30% less money this July than they did last July. Remember, our major maintenance formula is in statute. It uses, there are certain variables in there that come from RS means, and there's a Wyoming factor that we get from the folks here in town. And you plug all those numbers in, it spits out what every district should receive.
Not funding. Okay, well, first of all, why did you withdraw that recommendation?
It was the governor's recommendation, yeah.
Okay, the gov said pull it out. Do you know why that would be Governor Freudenthal?
For a number of reasons. One, the component level funding that you have been providing is really a sort of an addition to major maintenance, but it's more directed to where the needs are, where the major maintenance distributions don't necessarily end up where the needs reside.
Are they redundant?
Exactly. It could.
They are redundant, or they could be redundant.
They could be redundant.
Under the profile for the components that you have set out in the proposed components, I mean, all of the components are part of your original rec. So my assumption is they wouldn't have been redundant to the components that you had recommended.
That's correct. And also, the governor wanted to see that trend in use of major maintenance dollars that we just saw for the first time on last year's report, which was deploy the dollars you've been getting, right? Because up until now, whatever we would distribute in July, a year later, we'd spend some percentage less than that. And that had been a trend. He was looking for that trend to be reversed, and it finally did. But... Okay, so if we go back to page 3 of your handout, and we've graphed bienniums 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and so forth. You notice in every one of the first three bienniums, the districts were appropriated more than was spent. And there are all sorts of reasons for this. I'll be happy to discuss them. But that difference has been accumulating in bank accounts. These are separate, you know, major maintenance accounts that districts maintain. And the governor's position was until they begin to deploy, are able to, or for whatever reason, can deploy as much or more than they receive, there's no sense in appropriating more.
This schedule on 3 doesn't tell me a lot because, frankly, my belief is that we've allowed them to accumulate dollars for large projects. So there could be instances where districts would intentionally accumulate for a large project. Am I wrong on that?
That's a partial explanation in some cases, not an across the board. Okay. So there are a number of reasons. One, the rules associated with use of major maintenance was in flux. Okay, there was always this question of, should this be funded with CAPCON? You know, I would rather do that than use major maintenance. If you recall, the legislature came up with this minor cap concept of two, and it turned out to be $200,000 per district. So during this period, all these things were being tried as if they were experiments, if you like. And there was some uncertainty. Another was the efficiency of deployment, right? Knowing exactly what it is that you're going to do. You wouldn't think this was such a complicated affair, but it really can be, especially in the larger districts. The processes to identify, organize, and tackle those projects that are of highest need is not so simple. The stereotypical process begins with a principal asking teachers, forwarding that to central administration. They have a committee that sits there and sorts through requests, comes up with a list, and they go out and they do them. Not necessarily a direct correlation between that and building needs. So today, with the more sophisticated assessment tools, we can actually identify the condition of components like doors and windows and roofs and so forth. And in our planning meetings with the districts, we begin the conversation there, and then there are usually other projects that the districts will identify that we didn't. For example, a building may get an okay score for carpeting because half is new, half needs to be replaced. The districts are good at bringing that to our attention.
Ken, I'm not sure if I understood the explanation. If we go look to 09-10.
09-10, okay.
Under your, on table, on page 3, I could see where there was a trend for we were over-appropriating and the agencies or the districts were underutilizing the funds. Then when we reversed that trend, so it looks like the word got out, you don't use it, you're going to lose it, or we're going to do that, but whatever it is, the trend reversed.
Correct.
Now, so that would suggest to me that we can influence what the districts are doing by saying, look, we're going to begin looking, taking a more close look at that. The question now is the... What would the $14 million be utilized? Would it be well utilized? Would it be a good investment for us to put that into major maintenance?
My recommendation, Mr. Chairman, is to not do that at this time. We have the districts generally have enough reserve in their major maintenance to tackle this summer's projects. That, however, is a fair question for the next biennium.
Representative Harshman, is that consistent with what you folks thought, or did you get that far into it?
Mr. Chairman, and you remember a year ago when we were looking at how these two, you know, with the foundation program and CAPCON are really interconnected now, and we were pretty concerned, the projections, so we lowballed it pretty low on CAPCON, and... had a lot of discussion about it. So it's a lower deal, but we felt pretty comfortable leaving that $14 million out.
I just want to verify or make sure I understand that in the block grant to the school districts is actually the major maintenance formula. Is that correct?
No. Mr. Chairman, the major maintenance formula is separate. It's in our statutes. It's the routine maintenance that's in the block grant.
Okay, so follow up on that. So with the major maintenance in there, but is that set in a formula that is in statute, actually, so can't be messed with? It is, you know, 12 cents a square foot, whatever.
That's correct.
Okay.
Matt, you'll let the other Matt know what was going on there. Further questions on major maintenance, and we'll go on.
Well, I don't know if it's major maintenance. It's on the your 39.
We're going to go column by column. Let's
go with okay. Well, I'm in the front, Mr. Chairman. And the question and Chairman Harshman, this might be for you because you're on that committee. Is that I see there's a lot of demolitions here, but I don't see constructions matching up with them. And in one case, I think in Goshen, I think I know what the demolition is, but I don't see any dollars for that. And I'm wondering that some of those dollars aren't construction dollars, but they use that use other dollars to take care of the demolition, or how's that going to work?
Mr. Chairman, you know, for a period of time in there when inflation was rampant, demolition and construction were separated. Right, but let's save the money. We can do the demo later. Let's build our school. Let's repair our building, whatever. So what we have, we don't do that anymore. So today, when we put together a budget for a project, it's complete all the way through the demolition piece because we found out very quickly that once you separate those two, that demolition it's easy to keep pushing it back, right, because it's never as important, as critical as, you know, unless or until a town, for example, Grable comes to mind. The little town of Grable they had a deal that the new school gets built and this old thing comes down. And when it was delayed, they had a hissy. And, you know, it became a safety issue. The children had broken in at one point, becomes an eyesore in the community. You can imagine. So these are deferred demolitions. That we thought here's an opportunity in the supplemental budget to either get rid of them completely or put a serious dent in them. Now, in some instances, there are communities that always think and wish and hope that they can take over the building from the school district and do wonderful things with them. sometimes they succeed, often they don't. They underestimate the obligation. And we disclose everything to them. We coach them in dangers of doing that. But what you're seeing here are these deferred demolition projects. And what the governor said was, rather than estimates specific to each project, you have a lump sum. So in those instances that a community takes over the building, the dollars don't get locked up with that project and not used. You can shift them around, get as much done as possible with, and he picked that particular number.
If we took column two, which is the $61 million that's in the budget, if we go back to page eight of our budget, if we break them out by component, will they add up to those categories? So you'd have $45,575,000 of new construction. You had $5.5 million of planning and design, $8.1 million worth of component level, and $2.6 million of ancillary.
Mr. Chairman, they should, yes.
Okay.
The 61.9 of the two are supposed to be.
And so by category, if we looked on the spreadsheet, we would go through your components would be all the components.
Yep.
Your construction would be construction. Your ancillary. I don't see any ancillaries on the spreadsheet. That's
down towards the bottom.
Nor do I. And I'm not
41,
sure.
42, and 43, Mr. Chairman.
Say that again?
I think it's 41, 42, and 43. Is that the bus garages on SFC priority?
Yes.
Project priority? This is I'm on page 10. Is that what you're looking at, Mr. Chairman? Or are you looking at the handout?
I'm looking on the handout.
Okay, and I think that, Mr. Chairman, that's on the top of the second page.
The construction of ancillary buildings.
Just to back up a little bit, I wasn't sure what you're working off. So you're looking at this handout with the governor's budget, what's in the budget. And I guess so the first you asked the question about the components, if they add up. Now, they're totaled on here. If you look on the first page, you asked about components. On this spreadsheet, it's $8.8 million, and the governor's budget, it's $8,189,000, so we're missing about $700,000 somewhere in there.
Oh.
Or this is.
Mr. Chairman, he made a deduction, a reduction, if you like, in the demolition, and lumped them together. So he lumped them all together, and he reduced it by that amount.
Well, but then if they did that, then why the final numbers are coming out, so he had to add in somewhere else because he had the same grand total, 61,934,428. So if he deducted there, he had to add it in somewhere else. See what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That would explain the ancillaries, and you can do that. But, you know, when we budget it out under the, if we adopt the governor's rec and it's intended to implement this schedule, it ain't going to, there's a difference. Did you catch it, Bill? Do you know where the difference is?
Mr. Chairman, there's a $200,000 item in that second column on the handout, page two, right above the total.
Yes.
What
it's
is that
land purchase piece?
Yes, in Glen Rock, Wyoming. That's right. So,
and is that in your? Is that in the governor's budget? He just put a different category.
He added that back in later. Yes.
All right. So we're okay then. So that would go at. You'd add the land purchase in his to pick it up to the 8,189,204. Does that work?
Yes. part of it.
Yeah, I think it does. Okay. Gotcha. Now, by category is, I mean, is would ancillary category allow you to expend it for that category, or do we have to recategorize that 200?
I don't believe so, Mr. Chairman.
Bill?
Mr. Chairman, give me a second.
All right. While you're thinking about that, now let's – the next topic I want to shift to is in the agency request for component items, you've got a 10.384685. Governor only recommended the 8189204, so there's a difference of $2,195,481. What is that difference? What component projects did you ask for that didn't get funded? And are they in the spreadsheet that's spreadsheet number 39?
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chairman. So,
okay, where would we find them?
So the changes that the governor made subsequently were he was waiting to get some questions answered about from the Attorney General whether or not major maintenance could be used to address the construction around the security vestibules. And we got the – right, that was $1.361 million. So that was subtracted. The land purchase was added back in. And then demolitions, the total sum of the demolitions was reduced.
The only thing that's discouraging me now is I don't know that we have a spreadsheet that would accurately tie into the governor's recs. Do we have – I mean, does the spreadsheet that you provided at page
page 10.
I think yours is at page 10. So does page 10 tie in exactly to the gov's recs?
I believe so, yes.
All right. And that's does page 10, that column tie in exactly to spreadsheet 39? All right. So let me ask, if you had more money, would your recommendation have still been the same?
Yes.
The whole thing that we haven't even talked about. And if that's going to be the driver now in the state and be listed as priority number one for the SFC, then we got a lot to talk about.
All right. And so we
didn't want to go there.
And Mr. Chairman.
The security vestibules are what I think they are. They're essentially a security facility out in front that people have to go by to check in.
Correct. And that work is done routinely and typically with major maintenance dollars. There were just a handful of instances where they had to enclose a covered porch or covered entry to create that double entry. And by the strict definition of major maintenance, that added square feet to the building, therefore we weren't allowed to do it. So it was put on the list specifically to address rules associated with deployment of major maintenance. We got the Attorney General's opinion and removed them. The agency didn't have the authority to do that on its own.
All right. So everybody's comfortable with the removal of
yes.
the security vestibules and the final...
Vegetables.
Is that what I said? Vegetables. Vestibules. Vestibules. And then Senator Meyer, I guess you want that one.
No, I don't need one. No, I don't want the one in Goshen County. I'm glad to see it's off. The question I'd have, though, is on security, is it something that we're going to have to put into the square footage calculations on new buildings? Is this somewhere this is something that you're looking for direction through select facilities or the legislature, or what's a plan in the future? Because that's going to add square footage to everybody.
Right, Mr. Chairman. That is in our design guidelines. It's something that we do on all new buildings, and as time and circumstances permit, we're retrofitting old buildings to them. You know, back in the old days, that what districts, what schools would think is you put the office in the middle of the building so it was equal distance to all the parts of the building. Today, that is not the case. It's typically at the front entrance, has to do more with access and security and so forth. The impact on the footprint is minimal. It's really not an issue. This was strictly an interpretation of the rules associated with use of major maintenance. The districts are happy to use their major maintenance for it, and we had to clear that up with the lawyers.
All right. That takes us to Representative Harshman. With respect to the committee recommended the $32 million, the governor augmented that to $61,934,428. If that was the final number, would the capital construction projects that he added in have been approved by your committee? I mean, would that, if you'd gone up to the $61,934 number, would you agree with that allocation?
Well, what part of you, I guess I want to make sure, before I say yes, I want to make sure I'm looking at the same thing you're looking at, Mr. Chairman. And I think we've squared away as I went back to the summary page on page 8. It looks like planning and design is squared away in my mind. Those numbers match. The component level with the 200,000 added into it to the 8189 matches. The ancillary in the governor's budget is 2.645. I don't know if that adds up to our ancillary, what we had. We didn't fund any of it as a select committee. We didn't fill about building the two bus garages in a central administration office. I think that adds up to that 2.645. Mr. Chairman, just before you go any farther, those two 850s for design that you just talked about referred to Fremont 2 and Carbon 1. I think the governor put those at 900, if I remember, in his budget, just looking.
All right.
Okay.
If we did that, then the 61,934 must have been adjusted somewhere else. Worry about the 50,
yeah.
Okay? The question is, in general, well, actually, Harshman, look down on, he's got 50-50 on planning on number two and number one right below under planning of capital construction projects. So that would take it to the 900.
Correct.
Oh, sure.
So it would add up.
Sure, gotcha.
Okay, so question I have is, had the select committee added that additional funding in, for is that where you would have added it in on those projects?
It comes into that, what is that number again, the governor's number, 61,934?
Right. So those
yeah,
are
you
projects
can see
that
it.
You've not prioritized.
Right, you can see it. I mean, it, the grand total from both pages, second column, 61,934,428,
right.
That's the revised November. Now, this came to us in September, and we knocked it down to, with that 38, and we knocked it down to 32, if I remember right. And then we did some changes, too, but we came back with 32, and you can see the differences. We authorized some, but we didn't fund them.
Why did you reduce it?
Well, it was just a matter we weren't sure if first of all, about the money situation. This
okay,
was
let's
in
assume
September.
The money's off the table.
Well, and then we wanted to pick out the ones we thought were ready to go or higher on the priority with the money available.
If we did the 61, is everything that's there in the governor's rec an appropriate priority level spending?
That takes the biennial budget up then to about, what, two? What is it, 152 we approved
well,
last?
What difference does it make? The question
it takes it up to about 210.
On the budget?
Oh, I think you, yeah. I mean, we can do them, no doubt about it.
Would these, if the select committee had teed up that amount, are these the projects that are next on the list?
I understand your question now. I think so. These are on the 2009 needs index, if I remember right. And the stuff that's been presented to us today, and I haven't had a chance to flesh it out, is the 2010. We've been real deliberate about working through the list before we jump lists.
Fair enough. And are you going to argue that we should stay at the 32, given our profile, or are you going to argue it's going to be at least 61 or greater?
Oh, I think, Mr. Chairman, I would support a higher level. There's no doubt. I'm not going to sit here. I think in this climate, and I think we'll know more this spring, but we were building buildings at well over $220 a square foot. If we can build them now at $170, I think we're money ahead to do it. And I'm not sure that we can yet. Our last summer we could. I don't know if we can this summer. I don't know that. But
all right. So with respect to my, I think the question of the committee is, anybody have trouble with the 61,934,428 if it's expended as profiled on the sheet number 39 handout. Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I don't have a problem with it, but first I wanted to make sure that the number that we're using as far as funds available for capital construction is that number 117 million at the bottom of page 5 on our profile.
Let's go back through it again. Okay, you've got your – everybody get out the goldenrod. The funds available, if you expend...
What page, Mr. Chairman?
Five of the goldenrod.
Yeah, I've got it. Page 4 is what you're looking
right.
at.
Right. So if
page
you...
Page 5.
You'd have to go through the calculations, but if you expend money, what is more likely to happen is that the transfer, the tip, or is what I call in that tipping into the Common School CAFCON account would probably be reduced. I mean, the question is whether you reduce the tip. All right, what's the driver? Is it the tip or the 117 that causes the tip?
Mr. Chairman, there's a couple of drivers here. I would argue that you've got
500 and something.
The 498, 780, 238 to work with. That's assuming no money would tip.
That's what I page 4.
It's right both. Mr. Chairman and Representative Stewart, it's both on pages 4 and 5. On page 4, if
yeah,
you look under school CAPCON account, look at the second subtotal line under school CAPCON. See that transfer to CSPLF holding account, that 498? That's the number.
Yeah, $500 million you could spend, or you could prevent the sweep, or you could prevent the tip. Now, in the event that we spend more money, then we would debate how we want it to relate on the holding account, whether we want the tip to stay where it is or whether we want to reduce the tip and hold more in the account. And we can interrupt everything in that bill for the 2 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That, now I know.
With
Thank
that
you.
In mind, Senator Meyer.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, I suggest we don't spend that 498 down to more than the 250. If we left 250 in the school capital construction account, then we'd have that for the next biennium.
Yeah, I think that's we'll have that debated.
Yeah.
But then the other thing I'd look at is the other schools that we have here that are in the 119 on the expanded project list. I'm a little bit concerned of all that construction happening in Natrona County all at one time.
But we haven't gotten to that yet.
Okay.
Well, we're not there yet.
Let's get
the question on the floor was, is everybody comfortable with the 61,934,428? So that's everybody's there. That's likely there. Now we shift to the next topic. And the next topic is going back to the handout, page 10. And what we asked, the department to do was bring to us projects that are next on the list that could reasonably be completed if we authorize the money. So you only brought us, as I understand, projects that you think that were, they may not be shovel ready, but they could become shovel ready within this biennium, and they may not start this summer, but they'd at least start the following summer. Is that what I... Tell us what you did.
Yes, following spring. Everything you said was correct. About this time next year.
Back to that list, it is true that right prominent is Natrona, Kelly Walsh, and a third high school in Casper, all of which is a ton of money. And Casper hasn't quite sorted out what they want to do. Let me ask you the first question. If we have this multiple problem,
yeah.
What?
Mr. Chairman, just for the record, that's your opinion. But
well, I'm just reading you guys from Casper. You can't decide what it is. But, listen, but as I understand, is it better to do all three projects at the same time?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
So if we were going to tee it up.
Senator Meyer's question earlier about there's a lot of construction in one place, I just remind you that here in Cheyenne, they did exactly that, and it was done quite well, two major remodels. And it works because the two existing high schools are going to be done while the kids are attending the school, right? So it's not – it's a lot of dollars, but it is in small bites. So they're going to isolate parts of the campus, do that project, move children around, isolate. So it tends to be a lower pace of activity for a longer period of time. And so really, there will be an elementary school under construction, the new high school under construction, and then these remodels. And it is important for them to be at the same time because they have spent a great deal of time and energy working out all the logistics, all the curricular-related things. And it's complicated. They have actually completed that work. Architect selection is finished or almost finished. And they're ready to go into design, all three of them. And that's why they will all be under contract with an architect and a contractor by the end of the biennium.
Now, even if we change the statute that's going through with respect to prioritization, would it change these?
No.
Okay.
I don't.
So these are the next up?
Yes, sir.
So the issue that we have is, do we want to tee up another $119 million of construction that some will begin now and it may not actually go out to completion a year from now, but if we don't do anything, it's going to be 2 years away.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Simply, then they will be at the top of your next list.
That's right. So right. If you want
and
to
everything
get,
just gets delayed that much farther.
If you want to get Casper off the feeding trough, you got to feed it.
They're not.
That's all you get.
No,
okay.
The only thing that was what I was wanting to point out on the department's handout, page 10, because you see 2010 needs index numbers by all these other projects except for you know, you have 8 and 10 there, and then there's nothing by Casper because those rose up in the 9 index, and they're already partially funded in a phased deal. I think we funded nearly $15 million to these projects a year ago at this time, plus probably $4 million in design money. It's been, I think, 4 or 5. It's, so there's already about $20 million sunk into these three projects.
Let's now ask, let's shift the questions for a moment and make sure everybody, let's assume we decide to tee up that. I mean, if we want to add more projects, is everybody agreeable that we will add them in priority as they're listed on that list? Is there anybody that has any other ideas? So that is the priority they'll be added on, okay? And then let's look at those projects. Is there anybody that would be uncomfortable or wants some more information with respect to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 projects in the event that a majority were to authorize any one of those five? I don't know. Well, the markup will decide what's there. The issue is somebody think that something on that list shouldn't be there or they need more information? Senator Von Flatern.
Just a question, Mr. Chairman. Would this happen so we come back in February if one of these or all these didn't make it this markup in this session? But we come back in February, the money would be, I believe, if we moved them to February, available almost immediately after that, or immediately after that, I guess. So how much of a delay or what would this cost the state should that happen?
I don't know what you asked
there. If we don't do it this budget, supplemental budget, but actually
if we wait till a year from now,
and then the money's released almost immediately, I mean in March sometime, they would actually have that funding. And so with that in mind, what kind of injury to the state would that cause, or is it just a delay in these projects?
Okay.
Or not a delay?
Are you suggesting, I mean, the question is, we could tee up the design money and just put out the design but not the construction. Is that what you're suggesting?
Mr. Chairman, it could be either way. I'm just wondering what the injury to the whole process is if we don't do it this session but do it in the next budget and the money's available in March of 12.
Maybe it's you say injury, or what's the impact on
impact? That would be impact in the Trona, impact to the state on finance.
Mr. Chairman, it would be at a rate of 0.25% per month on inflation every month that it's delayed. But admittedly, the way these projects are going in design this month, so about it would be a 2 to 3 month delay. About is what you're looking at. So the injury is relatively small, and that's why when it was when we contemplated all this in the last budget session, we didn't have a lot of heartache over how much money, because realistically it was going to take that long to get. I just, you know, you were asked for options, so we brought it to you that we could get these under contract. So when you meet for your budget session the next time, you know, you'll be looking at the next crop of projects. Now, there are a couple of things you should also think about. There is no contingency anymore. There is no inflation, unanticipated, emergency-type bucket of monies. The way the process works today, the lowest priority project is the contingency. Okay? So it becomes the project that's postponed to fund higher, you know, issues above it. And that can come from an increase in costs. When we open these bids next 2-3 months, and if cost per foot is a little bit higher, the lowest priority project, not yet contracted. Okay, so the Gillette bids are being opened today, right? And let's say those bids come in at $5 a foot higher than our current 3-school average. We adjust the budgets of all the schools above it. If it uses up our $3 or $4 million leftover monies, then we're good. That school gets contracted, we sign it, we're done. Then we open up a contract or a bid 2 months from now, and it's higher still, right? Now the next lowest project has to be postponed to fund those. This would be with a zero supplemental budget. So when you do a supplemental budget, the list now gets extended. Now we go to the bottom of this. So it would be the Kelly Walsh renovation at $20 million. Those dollars then double as your emergency slash And then there's always unexpected turns and twists. And some, I mean, there's no shortage of issues. One would be Granger. $475,000 to a small project. Their population has dropped now to 6 children. And there's debate about whether or not they should come to town. So there are, and if they did, then that those monies would be not used and so on.
Sure. That answer your questions?
Yeah, and I had a
question. So, Representative Berger.
Well, thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman. Do all districts recognize that priority list and understand that process? That the last one on the list is the contingency.
It's in our budget.
I can assure you, Mr. Chairman, that Campbell County does.
Okay. Yes, they certainly do.
It's been reiterated by the select committee, by us.
Good.
But, you know, it's one of those things that people hear it, but not really, till it actually happens. Then I assure you the phone calls will come. I think.
Mr. Chairman,
what
would be, you know, and we could write that contingency course as tight as we want it, but what would be an appropriate amount, you think, that we set in a local savings account that, you know, would it be $10
million?
Would it be, is it a percentage of something?
Yes. In the old days, we had a 5%, what we call, what Mr. Shivler referred to as the SFC contingency fund of about 5%. We could do that. We could, Dr. Loam yesterday recommended tying it to that inflation factor of 3%, but something in that neighborhood, $7.5 to $10 million. I think we've got our budgets and cost estimating so tight now. There are really surprises when they
What about, Mr. Chairman, just, you know, what are some other things? I know, like this property acquisition thing in Glen Rock.
Yes.
You used to have money for when, you know, kind of like we do with the state, you kind of have opportunity, you know, projects of opportunity, and then they come open and you can't get them. There's certain parcels we probably need to get at certain places.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. That's a very good point, and we refer to that as the opportunity cost. In fact, that particular project, the $200,000 one, was on there to have this conversation. We can't, I mean, you can buy a piece of property, I suppose, whenever, but it not at reasonable costs usually. Those opportunities come not at our timetable, but just when they do. And without an authorized project and specific funding, it gets very difficult to act on them when there is no flexibility. So this was an example to exact. I agree with you completely.
So, for example, we used to tie that in. Commission approval, of course, and
of
all
course.
Those things in
yes.
the plan of whatever the project is, those kind of things. So.
Yes.
So those two things are maybe something we could think about
with
since we got a little extra
attached.
Money.
Yes, yes. With
okay, it's been pretty, you know, these last budget cycles pretty tight. That stuff all went by the wayside. So, okay,
well,
thank you.
I don't have to disagree with me. I think the issue there is whether, two issues. One is do we create a contingency fund for opportunity acquisition of land things, which would be smart because we ought to, I think it is true, we ought to be buying property when it works and when it's, when we can do it at an economical price instead of waiting to the last day and all of a sudden the price drives up. Having said that, the other issue is should there be contingency on the CAFCON amount? Now that you're on the bubble, it makes it a little bit interesting, but the reason why I think you took off that is to force these districts to do it for these amounts. So I guess, for example, Casper, what we want Casper to do it is to do it for these budgeted amounts. And if you had that contingency, then that's it's an encouragement for them to
yes,
we
have
a little more.
We have, Mr. Chairman, we have a little experience with that in the auditor's account, you know, with their health. And the other thing it did, I think, budgeting this way, people didn't sit around and talk about it forever. They realized, hey, if I sit long enough, I might be the contingency, and people got in gear and got their projects going in a hurry.
Are there projects out there that are designed and ready to go but are not in the that we could build this summer, but they're not in priority?
Not this summer, Mr. Chairman. Next spring. And
right.
Those are the ones listed. And that's a very good point you just raised about this balance between. It cannot be easy. The contingency funds cannot be easy to get at. So you need to attach sufficient controls to make it so that pressure to come, you know, to meet budgets is there. And it's legitimate and it's fair. And we need to take him seriously. It's truly a last resort. We've tried everything under the sun. Now we have no choice. We have to go get this. And
now there's another aspect of it. If we tee these up, it's in everybody's interest that Casper get the three facilities planned and go next year, because it's a huge impact on our construction folks. And if they don't get it next summer, then and we delay it a year, then they're going to be competing. All of our construction costs may go up because it's such a large item.
That's correct.
So it may be what we want to do is say the authorization is only authorized if they go to construction next summer, and they lose their authorization if they don't go next summer.
I'm not sure if that's necessary.
Because otherwise, you just drive up the rest of our budgets.
I don't know if that they're ready to. Are you talking 4 months from now?
We're talking about not this summer, a year from
not
now.
Not summer of 11, but summer of 12. Yeah.
Summer
I
of 12.
Think those things are, I think that's fair.
Is that right?
Say?
You're planning them in the summer of 12, correct?
Yes. We're confident that all of these projects will be under contract by before the end of the biennium.
So that would require cooperation and from Casper and Casper Green to it.
No,
hey, Casper's
have.
Agreeable to everything, man.
Yeah,
we just
whatever. Okay, well,
hey, we just we'll host your basketball tournaments. We'll do whatever you want. We'll do everything.
All right. So, is everybody now comfortable that if we debate in priority and that these projects that are listed on that page could be funded for really in 2012 construction, if that's where the debate goes? Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I'm pretty comfortable with the idea of the lower priority items being the contingency, and I'm comfortable with kind of the tack that we're taking here, but I'm actually kind of in need of a little bit of remedial education here. What's the difference between the SFC project priority and the 2010, I assume that means needs index?
Yes.
I guess just a simple explanation of what those two columns are telling me would be helpful.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wallace, the process begins with the needs index. It is a macro, quick look. We get these scores from doing a condition assessment of our buildings. We do a capacity analysis. We do what we call a functionality assessment. And these are some tools that we developed with our districts and a group of experts. And that puts our buildings in a particular rank, in an order of 1 through 323. So that those numbers in that column refer to that place, that their place in the 0 to 323. Okay. It is simply designed to sort of prioritize our buildings in a particular order. Okay. It helps focus the conversation. Right. Then so we start from the top of that list, and we look for a clarity of the problem. Like, why is this building on top of the list? Are the reasons for it being there accurate? Is the data, there, et cetera, et cetera. And then we look for a remedy. And that remedy can be non-construction remedy. It might be something as simple as reconfiguration or some other moving, closing a building, consolidating buildings, that kind of thing. Or it can be a remodel, or it can be a new construction. So out of that conversation, it occurs during what we call facility planning meetings, which will begin here shortly after the session, all through next summer, come a list of projects that then we take to the select committee, ultimately to the Appropriations Committee, and then that's that list on the left that we're talking about. We do our best to put them in some order, so when you have your discussions and debates and those dollars move up and down, you can draw lines at different places and have your discussion.
So, Mr. Director, Mr. Chairman, so that 1 through 48 on the left is simply for our reference. We can quickly point to it and say, hey, it's Project 15 on the SFC.
Okay.
It really means nothing in terms of how needy or...
That's
okay.
Correct.
Okay.
So it just simply means so it's for our reference.
To facilitate our conversation. Right?
So the plus symbol, the asterisk, and the X all mean something, I assume.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wallace, yes, they were corresponding with, if you look to the right of them, components were certain symbol, construction was a certain, it was a way for us to identify.
Okay, gotcha.
Those. And in the budget documents, because of the way the our statutes are written, they're grouped differently for budgeting purposes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just another question on these before we leave this. My question is for you and the co-chair. What's our timeline when we start markup? I mean, we've got really to the end of the session, or when are we going to knock this?
No, end of Friday.
Well, I mean, but we're going to mark this up. But when we go through and make amendments, though, that's going to be when?
To the budget?
Yeah.
Oh, I think we'll run the budget after crossover day.
That's what I'm wondering. We've got some...
No, you don't.
Well, maybe we don't. Well, here's my question.
You're going to send the budget out the way you want to support it.
Yeah, I hear you. And I have trouble with that always. But,
you do, but we're going to, I mean, hard you can't do
no,
that.
No, and
we
so my question, here's all I'm asking, Mr. Chairman, on the SFC project at the bottom, those five we're talking about, I guess as I look at the numbers, I see $10 million for the elementary school. Hadn't been designed. Those are just kind of ballpark numbers, I guess. These are pretty soft. So Fort Washakie K-8, 25, nice round number. So I guess if you come back to us next year and say, hey, we've got more or less or whatever, I look at this and it's pretty soft numbers.
Yes.
Any comments on that?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, your comments are fair. All but one of those are currently under design. So that number will firm up as the design proceeds. But what we do have are the number of children. We've done the population forecasting for those projects, which leads to a square foot, which then multiplied by a cost per square foot. That's the degree of hardness, right? So, but it really, we're not, the cost estimating isn't solid. So we get into the design, at least far enough in the design, you know, at least 10% in design to be able to say, yep, this is it.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'm just bringing that up, basically. I don't want you in particular and the committee is in general to scream like mashed cats if it comes back different a little bit. I mean, I think these are pretty soft.
We'll be happy when it comes at half that price.
Yeah, but it usually doesn't work that way. That's my point. So, thank you.
Sometimes.
You know, the other ones are rounded numbers, too, and the idea is to keep people in these budgets. Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, I'm not opposed to getting these schools on the bottom of the list keyed up, ready to go, and approving them. But, again, my decision on that is still tied to how we deal with what sweeps, what doesn't sweep over here in the Goldenrod.
Yeah, we'll get that in our markup discussion, and what we'll do is that when we get to that decision, we will go over and make sure everybody understands it, at least for that 10-minute period, what you're doing. I understand you have to look at these, you have to relook at them, you absolutely, all this comes in. I just got to try to get everybody through a sequence of comforts, because I don't know where we're going to go, but I want people to be I want to be arguing over things like what should sweep, what is in the account, what should be retained in the account. That's all a great debate. I don't want to be coming back and then arguing over, well, geez, Johnson County should have been number 4 instead of number 3. Okay. But now the other, before we get there, we want to make sure Senator Meyer wanted to make sure that if we add these other projects 44 through 48 on, is there any chance that they'll displace or that one of the other projects above would not happen and that this would displace one of those projects?
Mr. Chairman, no. Okay. In fact, by statute, it cannot. Right? We have an obligation to make sure that...
And we're going to go in descending order.
Correct.
We go down in descending order and knock them off.
That's right. We do our best to do it all like we did.
All right. All right. Now, Everybody comfortable with that spreadsheet? And we're really now back on spreadsheet number 10, page 10 on the School Facilities Commission. All right, any further questions with respect to those schools? Did anybody want to add any more schools in that were not there? Laramie, for example. Yeah, well, they actually are, but they're not there yet, so they're going to wait.
Mr. Chairman, I just have one question about planning, and I just want to, and you've brought this concern up before, too, just to make sure, and I guess I'm asking the director and the staff, you know, if we come back next year and have a significant amount of money and we're trying to budget for 2 years, do we have enough in the queue getting planned up? And I think that's something we kind of backed off a little bit in the last year just for the money. I mean, we didn't.
Mr. Chairman,
in your opinion, I guess.
That is correct. So the climate having changed, our charge is to get ourselves ready. And
so I guess if there's some more out there, maybe give us some more info in the next few days if you think these are a few more.
But because of the delays from last year, it'll take us this summer to work those up.
Okay.
And what we've done, just to let you know, we are moving forward our facility planning meetings. They're going to commence immediately after the session. I think some even before the session is over. So we're better prepared, have deeper conversations, and have a more thorough cost estimating and analysis. Our budget to you, because remember, that budget is due September 1. I mean, it's just right around the corner.
And if with the new statute, will that have a change in hierarchy behind what we're teeing up here?
No. We are, you notice this page here says the 2010 needs index. There will be one of these every year because populations shift, change. But we have not and will not have a new condition assessment until the biennium, the budget session after next.
All right.
We just finished our functionality scores. That's set now for the next couple of bienniums. Capacity is the only thing, and we're being more rigorous about how. Actually, to be honest, we've addressed, by and large, addressed most of our, if not all of our, capacity-related issues in the state. So the list is fairly static. But there will be a 2011 needs index that will accompany the budget you get in the summer.
Have we addressed all of the budget? Have everybody asked all their questions with respect to the budget? Let's talk about construction delivery methods. And we've talked to you a little bit about, we've already talked about some of the issues.
Yes.
And what are the issues as you see lined up and the governor's concerns, and how do we address those?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I can assure you that the select committee, the commissioners, also share the governor's concerns about issues of residency, contracting, procurement in general, and so forth. We've been working pretty hard on that. Now, we use the term CMAR as a delivery method, but it's not, it's a bit of a hybrid process. It's one that has evolved with this agency over time. It is not the traditional CMAR that most other architects or construction companies would define, okay? So on page 12 of your handout is these are the active projects, the ones that we report on regularly, okay? Some are in the design phase, some are in the construction phase. And we have a list like this for everything that's been done. And I can tell you now, we get a list of folks that are contractors that are quote resident contractors from Department of Labor standards. That's how we base our decision on that. But those that are defined or categorized as resident contractors have gotten about 80% of the projects from the School Facilities Commission on a numbers basis. So of all the projects that have been done, they've gotten about 80% of them. And you can see on this list here, both architects and contractors. Now, There is no residency requirement for professional services, but you can look at those names. I'm happy to tell you where these folks are located. Okay.
Would
they
you
are
that?
The architects.
Yeah, let us know.
Okay. Nancy Sandstrom. They're Utah. Plan 1 is Cody. Plan 1, Cody or Rock Springs. They're Wyoming, 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 DLR. Denver, CTA. Billings, Montana. TSB, Wyoming. Plan 1, Wyoming, Wyoming, Wyoming. JGA, they have an office in the state. They're Wyoming. So all but DLR, Sandstrom, and CTA or Wyoming are
three projects went out of state, everything else went in state.
Yes, and then it gets even a little bit more complicated. I use the auto industry as an example. You know, the car may have a GM label on it, but there's no telling where the parts inside came from. And that is true to some extent with these. Architects, so for example, CTA will subcontract to civil engineers, architectural engineers, or mechanical folks and others, and they are often local. So not 100% of the lead of the contract actually goes out of the state. Now, same is true with contractors. The subs are, even when a non-resident wins the bid, the subs are generally dominated by Wyoming subcontractors. So the way our delivery methods work, and Nancy, please jump in. Miss Nutbrock, right here behind me, is the person that manages this function in our office. And she can speak in much greater detail about all this than I can. But the way our CMAR project or process works, we go through a selection process. It's pretty rigorous. We have a committee of five, two state people from our office, two district employees, and those four are district-appointed people. Sometimes they're board members. Sometimes they're staff members in the districts. Those four people pick a fifth person amongst themselves that they all have to agree to. And those five people go through a pretty rigorous process of, you know what, this is a great time for me to turn this over to Mrs.
Committee, I'll start where Ken left off. We have a nice process of selecting the construction managers for our projects. And as a matter of fact, we're in the process of doing so for the three projects up in Natrona County right now. For construction management agent and at risk, we've hybrided our approach very much to take into consideration the desires of the legislature, desires of the Wyoming contractors community. They wanted to be able to see that the alternate delivery methods were also taking into consideration those subcontractor preferences. For example, if a general contractor is claiming a residency contractor certificate, not more than 30% of the subcontractor work can go to out-of-state subs. That's easy to apply when you're using a traditional design bid build delivery method. It gets a little stickier when you're using alternate delivery methods. But we've done our best to hybrid those alternate delivery methods to still suit the needs and the desires of Wyoming.
How do you enforce it after you select your CMAR?
That's a very good point. So when we're selecting a construction manager at risk or agent, it's selected on a qualifications base. Now we've gone to the extent to require the construction manager to publicly open bids. So when we get one GMP, he has essentially acted as a general contractor, and he's opening each one of those subcontractor bids, so we can see who that low bid is, and we can see after we tally up all of the low bids whether or not they're meeting that 30 or 70% rule.
What if it happens to be that all the low bids were all the low bids were out of state? I mean, you're now into a new phase. They elected that. Do they have to pick higher bids, even though?
Fortunately, we have not been in that situation yet, but that would.
So when they first opened the bids, though, so the
they've already contracted, or the 70% has to be Wyoming.
Right. And those subcontractors can be the lowest bid after preference.
Okay.
Right.
So they just have to count on the fact there's going to be at least 70% Wyoming. I suppose if that doesn't happen, they got to come back and say, hey, we can't meet our contract requirement.
Well, true. And we would have a discussion at that point about how we might best maintain that 30 to 70% split. Another scenario might be, and I was going to give another example. Even under a hard bid scenario, where we would be awarding a contract to a general contractor, and we would ask that general contractor to provide his list of subcontracts with their values, so we could determine that if he is in fact claiming Wyoming residency contractor certificate, he has to meet that 30 to 70% split. The scenario that could take place is that, for example, the finished carpentry would happen much later in the project. And if, for example, maybe that finished carpenter was to go out of business and we had to go with a second low bidder or choose another carpenter to finish that work, we're a year down the line already. A year has gone by since we've issued that contract to that general contractor. So that's a situation that requires some delicate conversation, just so the general contractor understands the intent of those rules and the intent of the statute. So any number of situations could occur after that point at which we do the evaluation of that 30 to 70% split and actually sign a contract.
Will you be with us when Rich comes to talk about these tomorrow?
I certainly can.
Would you please get the time from our staff to make sure we have all the... We're going to have all you guys in the same room at the same time.
Just a question, Mr. Chairman, on the 70-30 we're checking on, but isn't that in statute that it has to be 70-30? Or is that some rule? That's statute.
It's statute.
Yeah.
That's right. All right, folks. I know we could talk a lot about this, but let's shut it down on this. If you'll come back with us on find out when Rich is coming to talk about this, because what we're talking about is putting something in the budget to satisfy the governor that we're attending to it. Now, and the flip side of it is, if you'll get this chart to Chris Boswell and make sure that you've talked to him about this, because that's not information that I believe the governor has, and I think he's operating on information that's different than that.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Boswell has that now.
Okay.
And to their defense, we just simply ran out of time and could not have these conversations.
Well, we're moving fast. That's
fair
enough. Okay, everybody, all the questions, Senator Peterson.
As we talk about these contracts and these bids and the out-of-state or in-state preference versus out-of-state, in my profession, one instance that I've run into, and I don't know if the SFC is aware of this, but when you talk about furnishings, some of these new schools could be $500,000 with new furnishings. Architects don't want to mess with that. Contractors don't want to mess with that. So they turn it over to the local school board, and the local school board doesn't even want to mess with it, the bidding process. And so what happens is Brand X out of Colorado is put in charge of actually handling the bidding process for the school district. Brand X also has an inside tracking out of the bid.
Correct.
And most oftentimes win the bid because they are in charge of the bid. So we're allowing an out-of-state contractor to prepare the bid for the local school district, to specify the product, to sell the product, to install the product, and it's locked in from the get-go.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for bringing that up. It's absolutely true. So as we have slayed the bigger dragon, so to speak, we're starting to address these issues. So there's a young lady in our office who's focused on that subject now for some months, and we don't do that anymore. So the design, we take inventory, we go through a FF&E design process. We have some pretty clear guidelines on what is FF&E, what is under the regular block grant model funded that way, what is through construction and so on. Get all that pretty clear. And we either ourselves or we hire a third party sort of a non-interested design person that specs everything out, and we put it out for bid, and it's open for competition through everybody.
Find
but you're absolutely
you're doing
right.
On your FF&E.
Mr. Chairman, just one quick question on page 12 of your handout. You went through the design group as far as the architects. How about that next list, that construction group? Nelson Bodley, Malone Belton, and NWL. Are they in or out of state? Just curious.
Nelson Bodley is Utah. Malone Belton is Wyoming. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And CTA, again, is Billings. Naylor Wentworth Lund is
NWL.
NWL is Naylor Wentworth Lund, and they're also out of Utah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And the rest
thank
are...
you.
Sure.
Thank you. Ken, on that person that actually does the specs, the so-called non-interested party, do they actually go in and say the brand of HVAC, the brand of door knobs, the brand of windows, or do they give a spec that says that it has to, like if you're talking copiers, it has to do, it's equivalent? It is?
Yes, the latter. And that was part of the problem that Senator Peterson was referring to. These folks are coming in, they're speccing some specific product that they happen to be the only dealer for. See, that wasn't...
With the HVAC, that's performance criteria that goes into performance
entirely
design.
Different. This is
furniture,
FF&E.
Fixtures, and equipment should be a product or its equivalent.
Correct. Yeah. The
All right.
Mechanical equipment, that's...
I don't mean to rush,
but
I
understood
rushing.
Your example. Yeah.
We're going to shut it down now. Committee, you got 5 minutes to get back here. We're going to go to the Department of Ed, and we will be done by 7.
I know, you're waiting. Yeah. So now we're only 3 hours.
Well, I know for a fact you've been going for 11 hours straight. We have some of those at the department, but they have that mesh seat, so you get a little air. I think those are a little bit better. So are you expecting? Representatives, the senators, it has you down as being.
He is professional.
Part of my living.
That's what I figured. I figured that was at the top of the list, and then attorney was at the bottom. And
so, I didn't make much of the business itself, but other pilots.
I have another pilot.
Yeah. Right, while you're here.
Right now he's sitting in Jackson, so I don't text when he takes off.
All right. Education.
That was good, Phil.
Well, you know, I don't know why we're not building more schools.
Well, I know. And, you know, we now have an accepted priority.
The next one I get up. Laramie finally gets this. I don't get this until we get these, get Casper off the list. But, and my needs index is probably higher than theirs. Fred, how are you doing?
I'm good. I haven't been working straight through since 4:30 this morning. I only started at 7.
So. Well, I started at 5. So.
You started at 5?
Hello.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good to see you, Senator.
Good to see you.
I want to introduce you. Good. I have two of my instructional leaders here.
How are you?
Chairman Berger.
Hi, Rosie.
This is Cheryl Lane. She's an instructional leader, and she's student.
No, I'm from Sheridan.
Okay.
Oh, and you're from?
I'm from Holloway, Wyoming.
But
that was
in
Roger Clark.
Hi, Roger. Nice to meet you.
Operation.
Reconfigured
a little bit, repurposed, did it all through.
Well, we're going to ask you about that and get a list for you.
Yes, good to meet you. Had I met you before?
I think we probably have passed.
Okay.
Okay. I think so. Thanks so much.
And he's now your, is he your legislative liaison?
Yes.
Okay, good.
And actually, there's a team that he leads the team.
Okay.
He is the point person.
Point person. Okay, Roger.
What's Roger's last name?
Clark.
Clark. Yeah. Let's get started. With respect to the Department of Ed, there's no supplemental budget request, but there are changes that we've heard that are proposed or being proposed, and so what we want to do is go through changes, and I think from our point of view, we've been marching down a path of about 10 years on this new funding model that started with Campbell 1, and we want to make sure that our legislative policies are being followed and directed, and what the plans are. So, Superintendent Hill, if you want to start talking about, maybe a good start place to start is with your staff changes, what you're proposing, and who is leaving, who's coming, and what making sure that we have all those positions filled. And thank you.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, and members of the committee, I'm Cindy Hill, and I would like to introduce my staff. I have with me today Christine Steele. Christine is Director of Federal Programs, Laurel Ballard, and Laurel is our data and the actual, it's CIO.
Chief Information Officer for the WDE.
Thank you, Chief Information Officer, CIO. Roger Clark, Instructional Leader, Operations. Fred Hansen, Director of Finance, and Cheryl Lane, who is also an Instructional Leader, Student Learning. I'd like to go ahead and address the committee with some comments. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. I've eagerly awaited this day and the days to come to share my vision for education with you and update you on some of the important steps and that I've already taken. Allow me to step back and make some observations on the state of education in Wyoming. Over the past few years, we've all come to recognize the need for change, and we've been in a time of reflection on why our educational system ranks high in spending but does not rank at the top in results. Now, as we sit here today, we're ready to act and to achieve the educational reforms that the public so rightfully demands. And as you all are aware, there are numerous measures pending before the 61st legislature. I look forward to working alongside you this legislative session. I am thankful for my close personal relationships with members of this body, because I believe we all understand the importance of the strong partnership between the two branches to achieve our goals for our state and for our children. Education touches every life in Wyoming, and the public expects us to work together and to achieve our mutual purposes and not to be distracted with those things that might lead us away from our mission. I come here today personally committed to the educational growth of every child in Wyoming, and my department will be a reflection of this commitment. I would emphasize the personal commitment that the legislature has shown, and this committee in particular, in fully funding our schools. Everywhere I go in our state, I repeat the sentiment about the significant commitment shown by the legislature. My vision for education includes a dedication in instruction, accountability in our schools, and student measures that we can trust. Today, I'll touch upon just a few aspects of my focus on instruction. Instruction and results are the husband and wife of education. If we want better results, then we will increase instruction and the quality of instruction. If we want lower results, and who would want that, right? Then we would find ways of limiting instruction. Anything that takes time out of the classroom and limits instruction will be carefully examined. One area that we've identified immediately is the need to reduce the amount of paperwork that the department is requiring from our school districts. We have begun the task of looking for needless duplications and focusing on information that is truly relevant. Instead of having our school district spending enormous amounts of time, for example, sitting and resolving 1,400 errors on a report, wouldn't we rather our schools be focusing on instruction? I have been in school districts already to start reducing needless reporting burdens, and I'm pleased to report that we have had an immediate positive impact on the issue. I thank those school districts with whom we've already been working and who have agreed to pilot our efforts to achieve greater efficiency. We will continue to work with our schools to provide for sensible data collection. As you know, I come directly from the trenches, and I will serve the role of constantly measuring the practical effects of what is being proposed. I remain committed to the principle that the best intentions can have unintended consequences of placing further administrative burden on our teachers, therefore reducing instructional time, which only negatively impacts results. Remember, better and more instruction yield immediate results. Next, you have heard me speak on the importance of instructional leadership. The natural and essential companion to teacher accountability is leadership accountability. This discussion pertains to the leadership found in our buildings with building principals and local superintendents. Building principals and local superintendents like teachers must be held accountable for results. Teachers should not be required to take on the entire burden of improving our schools. We must expect the same personal commitment and responsibility of our leaders, principals, and superintendents as we expect of our teachers. If we are to hold our teachers accountable for results, we must hold their leaders accountable as well. Where you find schools yielding results, you'll find effective leaders, instructional leaders. If you find a school does not have an effective leader, an instructional leader, no amount of data or assistance or money will lead that school to improvement. I will come back from time to time to both this committee and to the body to seek advice and report on what we've learned and recommend steps as we develop our services most efficiently and effectively on behalf of our children and our state. I'm submitting to you today written testimony reflecting some of my personal beliefs relating to education that you will hear from me time and time again as we talk about educational issues over the next 4 years. I look forward to the committee's questions, and I will begin by answering the first one as to who is leaving and who is coming by Senator Nicholas. Madam Chairman, and Co-Chairman Nicholas, I would like to start by explaining that I repurposed the deputy position into, I had one deputy position and two director positions that were open. And I repurposed those three positions into what would be identified as instructional leaders. And that was to focus our attention back on instruction. We're changing the focus within the department. We had a deputy and two directors that were more focused on a bureaucratic model, and we're taking a different approach right now. So I worked with Human Resources, Dean Fawcett, and repurposed those positions.
Mr. Chairman, just a question on the positions. You have the deputy is a political appointee. That was Mr. Simpson in the previous administration.
Correct.
I'm assuming. And then the two directors, are those political appointees as well, or are those positions? What were the two directors previously directing?
They were permanent employees, and one was over what we call our quality assurance unit, and the other one was over health and safety and nutrition. Leeds Pickering had resigned long before I arrived, and Kay Post.
Mr. Chairman, as you restructure, it might be helpful to the committee just to kind of see a new flow chart, kind of your administrative flow chart, so we know who to contact and those kind of things if we need to.
Typically,
so, thank you.
In our budgets, we ask that agencies do that. So if you go back and look at the budget.
On page 13.
To the extent that there's a change in that, please provide us a new change chart.
Madam Chairman? Mr. Co-Chair, I did take a look at that, and at this point it showed seven directors. There are actually nine when I arrived in the department. It is now back to seven.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What was that? That went from seven to five, you said?
No. Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Representative Harshman?
Yeah. I was digging it out, so I didn't hear. I'm sorry.
The budget shows seven directors.
Correct.
When I arrived, there were nine.
Oh.
And I have now reconfigured, and there are seven.
Okay, thank you.
Provide us the names as the folks you've got assigned to those so that we can get it out to our colleagues.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I can do that.
respect to those seven people, are they the head of those, have they all changed? Or your deputy, you say you changed, you took the deputy out, or is the deputy still there?
The deputy is no longer, it's been repurposed. It is no longer a deputy position. It's considered an instructional leadership position.
So, I mean, a high chain of command, is he still in that chain of command, or does repurposing change the command?
It has repurposed the chain of command. We have three instructional leaders instead of a deputy and two directors. We have an instructional leader, operations, instructional leader, student learning, and an instructional leader, outreach. We've not filled the outreach position.
Well, when you say, so you've added two positions above the seven, is that what you've done?
What I did is that there were two positions that were director positions and one deputy position, and they all were leveled out as instructional leadership positions.
Not sure I still understand.
So, okay.
If you look at this flow chart, you put arms out on the state superintendents, or you go above, and there are three people now reporting directly to you.
There are three people reporting directly to me, but we're flattening the organizational chart. And we're in the midst of doing it, and in the midst of reconfiguring.
So when you flatten it, you add three more to the same. So you got seven, you add three, so there'll be 10 people directly reporting to you, but nobody reporting through a deputy.
No one will be reporting through a deputy. Those who are reporting on operations will report to Roger Clark. Those who are working alongside within the realm of student learning will report to Cheryl Lane, and the outreach, of course, would be reporting through outreach, and that might include special services, et cetera.
So when we see the new chart, what we'll probably see is three people reporting to you, and then the seven reporting to one of the three.
As we're in the middle of reconfiguring, that could be an option, but we do not have that. I have not imposed that as the organizational chart yet.
Now, with respect to the seven positions that were there on the chart, are those folks still with you? Are they leaving? Or?
At this point, they're all there, as far as I know to this moment.
When do you think you're going to have your new organizational chart draft? Is it something you're still working on? Is it something that's days away or months away? Or
I believe everyone would want it as soon as possible, but we are all still working on it. I have not put a time limit on it. I would like the staff to be part of this organizational reconfiguration.
Well, you might give us a temporary one, and then as things redevelop, updated as time goes then.
We can do that.
All right. What's next on your topic?
I'm here. It's your pleasure.
Mr. Chairman, we could perhaps go with
go through the list of the letter.
The list, yes. You and I both have, and I've just gotten copies for everyone. So.
Okay, and this list, so some of the issues that are outstanding out there, let's talk about the Pearson contract. What plans have you made, if any, with respect to that, and the status?
I would like my counsel to please join me with your permission. We have had many discussions about the Pearson contract, and in fact, we met with the Attorney General today.
Which AG is assigned to that?
We actually met with the Attorney General today, with Greg Phillips.
Greg, okay. Oh, we can always do this in executive session. We can do this think we have an interest in finding out what the status is. So we can skip over that, and we'll go into executive session when we're done.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next item is pause. Administration. What changes have you got planned, or do you plan that are different than, the first issue is, assuming the statutes stay the same, is your plan to administer a pause?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Within the statutes, we did notice that there were some changes being imposed with the pause administration, 2011 administration, but notice those late in December, intervened and spoke immediately with the districts, those who were working closest with our children, and identified that the imposed changes would not have been in their best interest. So we met with our assessment team, identified four remedies whereby we knew that we could address the needs of the students and keep it psychometrically sound while also not breaking our Pearson contract. Those remedies include, one, the imposed timing of pause. We actually changed that back to it not being a time test. It had never been a time test, and we did not think that would be in the best interest of our kiddos. We also identified the time frame, which had been 4 weeks and was reduced to 3 weeks. We opened it back up to the four-week window. There was an issue regarding the writing draft and the final draft being completed in 1 day, and we knew that best practice was that the students would have a day between both the draft and the final draft, and so that was able to be provided as well. And then there was a content, how the content test, the pieces of test were actually administered, and we were able to respond to the districts wanting to be able to administer the test, the math at certain points, or the reading or the writing, and intermix those, and we were able to adjust that as well. But we were very careful, again, to make certain that we didn't break any of our contractual agreement with Pearson, or make it so that it wouldn't be psychometrically sound and being able to use it for longitudinal data. So those are changes that were made and went into action on January 3rd when I was actually sworn in. Those went into action with our districts. And then we've put in approximately 12 hours focusing on exactly what the 2012 administration of pause would look like. Right now we have reduced the amount of time to the 2012 pause by 15 to 45 minutes, depending on how it actually is executed. One of my transition staff members attended a Pearson 5-day training last week, working alongside them regarding the 2012 and 2011 pause administration, and we feel confident that we are able to administer that test with the least amount of time possible.
I take it that the recalibration committee was contemplating changes that you didn't agree with, and then I didn't understand what action you took.
Mr. Chairman, would you remind me of the changes that I may not have agreed with?
And when you said there were things you didn't agree with, what were you?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, that had nothing to do with the recalibration committee. The imposed changes were coming from my predecessor's administration. They had been imposed, and those were occurring. The training was to occur with the districts in December, and the districts had no idea of where these changes had been originated, and they were merely responding to the changes. Again, the changes were that pause was going to become a time test, that the window had closed by a week. Instead of being 4 weeks, it was going to be 3 weeks, that they no longer could do the rough draft on 1 day and the final draft for the writing piece on the second day. It would all have to be completed with 1 day. And then there were imposed restrictions as to how you could actually administer the different content areas of the test, which really impose some hardships in our scheduling within our districts.
Those did come out of the recalibration committee and the experts. If we're going to have a summative test and we're going to want to compare test data from one district to the other, don't the tests have to be administered on the same terms and conditions and timelines?
Mr. Chairman, they will be. Those conditions will all be uniform.
If one of the conditions is there's no timeline, then that's not uniform.
But the fact is everyone has the extension of time.
Mr. Chairman, just a question that looking ahead to 2012. You know, a lot of us have ideas to see the eventual sunset of PAWS. You know, a lot of states are going to end-of-course exams, those kind of things, where really you can spread accountability for learning and instruction to all teachers. Currently, we just really are math and English teachers. And particularly like with the 11th grade test, you don't know, kid does great, was that because he had a great 11th grade teacher? Or did he have a bad 9th grade teacher? You know, you just don't know. But here's my point. Here's my question. We test writing, I believe, which is not required, I think, by No Child Left Behind. I think we're just required to do, the math, reading, and I think science now in a couple grades. Is that right? I see heads nodding. And I think there might be a bill out there. Are we heading that way? Because this writing deal has not gone through all the psychometric guys, and it's a little fuzzier than the rest of it, the way I understand. That's my first question. I'd like to see the phase out of writing, personally, but is there some talk about that? The second one about this whole stoplight deal and making it more of a formative type thing, I mean, it just doesn't seem to quite work. Like, I think the thing was way overambitious, you know, 6-7 years ago. So those are my two questions. Now, is that some of the talk in 2012? Make this thing less expensive, shorten it up, make it as painless as possible. So that's my two questions, the writing part and the stoplight part, I guess, to summarize. Any talk about that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Harshman, on January 4th, we met the entire day on just that. You asked regarding the writing and the phase-out. Our discussion revolved around how would we imagine PAWS without writing in 2012, and would we be able to identify a means for still providing that writing maybe on a local level? Would the department be able to support the local effort, knowing that what gets measured gets done, and that we know that our writing skills are critically important to our kids? So we could imagine doing that on a local level, and I certainly have spoken with that since then with five different districts in person, and each one seems to can imagine what that might look like. Knowing that that's about 13 months away, we know that there are some challenges there in order to put together a local effort that would be, again, consistent and statewide in nature, maybe with a similar rubric, but local efforts in identifying a prompt that might be culturally meaningful to their students. Last night I was in Fremont, 38, and they really liked the idea because they know that their students would like a prompt that really had to do more with their world than maybe a prompt that wasn't as meaningful. So we can imagine how we can standardize that a bit, but also make it local. Regarding the stoplight, I was speaking with Dr. Jim Popham today about how we might make this a more formative assessment, if that's even possible, and what the options might look like for PAWS in the future or any, maybe not even PAWS, but what our assessments might look like regarding the growth model approach. And he is certainly eager and willing to come and meet with any and all of us at any point. He says just about getting on a plane.
As Dr. Popman, he testified at the recall, and was he the guy that said this was the best damn test in the land? My question at that time, I thought to myself, is this, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but I mean, he's probably on retainer with the department? Or I mean, he's an expert. Is he an employee of the state of Wyoming now, or on retainer? I guess that's my question. I see some heads doing this. I don't know. And not that it influences his thing, but I mean, doggone. We got the, you know what I mean? We got the guy who made the hen house and telling us the hen house is secure.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, Laurel Ballard is here as our Chief Information Officer. And Laurel, with their permission, I'd like you to be able to answer the questions.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, Dr. Popham is one of the technical advisory committee. Every state has a technical advisory committee that supports the state assessment in the state. And so he serves as the chairman of our technical advisory committee.
So he does that volunteer?
It's a contract.
Oh, it
he's
is.
On a personal services contract.
What is his pay then on that? That's public record.
Yes, sir, but I am not the assessment director, so I don't work with that contract,
also
so I cannot tell you exactly how much.
If I would, I'd like to think that'd be interesting. Just kind of what we pay some of these experts and that kind of thing, if we could get this to one pager on that. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, that concludes.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Superintendent Hill. I received a very specific email from a math facilitator and secondary educator who was expressing to me earlier today some serious problems that he had with, and I believe he described it as being bullied by the Pearson representative in the development of questions, where 9 math teachers were being asked to review questions that were going to be on the exam, and only two of them were able to answer a particular question correctly because it was so poorly worded and poorly put together, but yet the Pearson person insisted that that be included on the test, and that 60% of their students subsequently weren't able to answer the question that the 9 math teachers had brought forward. So is there a continuing process of reviewing these questions? Are the educators involved in this? And is there a process to listen to the folks on the ground who are struggling with these kind of things?
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, Representative Wallace, Kevin Lewis attended the Pearson 5-day training last week, and I would like to defer to Kevin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wallace, there is a review process. They generally review during the summer and calibrate the questions and equate the questions each year.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wallace, I will be meeting with a Pearson representative following this meeting. They're waiting for me, and I would be happy to discuss your concerns. And I think that any time those occur, please let me know, because we need to address those. No one should be bullied, and certainly we need the questions that are in the best interest of our kids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With your permission and at your suggestion, I'll gladly forward you the message, and you can deal with it straight away.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Hill, have you given any thought to this pause testing? One of the big problems I feel is these students are instructed before they take the test that this test will have nothing to do with their grade. And if I were a 7th grader and the teacher told me that, I'd be staring out the window just waiting for the class to get over and move on with my business. And if it's not going to have anything to do with my grade, so the incentive just isn't there for the students to perform well on this test. And so the results, I fear, are not accurate. And so why test under those conditions? Have you given any thought to the incentive to have our students apply themselves more or ski trips, I don't know what the answer is, but this is the biggest problem of pause as far as I'm concerned, is there's no incentive to do well for these students. And then we use it as a direct reflection on our teaching and our schools, and it's broke.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, as you may have heard in Governor Mead's State of the State, he speaks to that issue about the motivation, or in this case, the lack of motivation of our students with PAWS. And we know that's a concern throughout the state. Certainly, I believe that our educators are working tirelessly with their students to try to elevate that motivation. And sometimes they actually, I don't know if they use ski trips, but I know that they use incentives within buildings. They did within mine. But I do know that this is a grave concern and something we're all working on. I agree.
With respect to the pause, I mean, I assume, is there any part of the pause statute that presently exists that you don't feel like you can enforce or implement in the absence of a legislative change?
Mr. Chairman, at this point, I don't know of any that I would that I had a difficulty with. I know that we can carry out everything that's there. I do believe that the people want pause to be as bare bones as possible. And as Representative Harshman mentioned, the writing portion of PAWS, that seems to be an issue within our communities, and I think we can do that locally, but I think we can all do that within statute.
I think the important for the legislature is that you follow the statute, you implement the statute. If there's something you don't like, then you need to lobby for a change.
Mr. Chairman, and I understand and agree.
And then with respect to the accountability bill that's coming out, were there issues that, have you reviewed it, or are there issues that you had with that, or that you didn't think that it would be easy to administer?
Where do I start, Mr. Chairman? At this moment, I can give you an example of the accountability bill, though I have not spoken with the authors about this issue, but the measure that's been identified. At this point, most of our schools would be an improvement, and that would be over 300 schools. And at that point, knowing that part of the phasing would be that the department would be involved in direct assistance to those schools, I may need a couple more staff members. over 300 students would be an improvement. So I believe that there will be discussion about that particular piece of the accountability bill. But so I'm cautious about how much I am concerned about, because I believe that those issues will be discussed. But I do believe that the bar has been set very high, and not that we shouldn't have that bar set high. I just want to make certain that I have the resources to follow through with what's expected from that accountability bill.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to swing back around real quickly to give more information. I know that we discussed the writing piece. I do believe there is currently a bill to remove that writing piece. I believe it's going to start on the House side. So just wanted to let everyone, folks, know that. And I know that going forward with these questions about bills, especially the accountability and the other ones that are in the House or in the Senate,
if they passed, then that'll be the law.
But they could change at any time all the way through. So I know how difficult it would be to answer those kind of questions. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, just a question on that accountability bill that the recalibration committee put together. Madam Superintendent, and I guess as I was just reading it again last night, and I think there's some real – I mean, we've chosen reading and math. We've said – and so what you said struck me. Have you guys done some mock run-throughs already, it sounds like? And I guess that was my question earlier drafting this, what's that going to look like? So then my next question, so you've done some mock run-throughs. Was that off of last year's data that was pretty messed up? And I'll just give you an example of last year's data. If you're using it at Natrona County High School, we had one young man, he might have been the only one in the state of Wyoming, absolute 100% on the ACT. Didn't miss a question. Perfect. One of the few and millions that take it. He was just proficient on math. And he tried really hard the first time, and then when the computer kicked him off, he tried really hard. And he's the son of one of our guidance counselors. He tried really hard the second time. Computer shut him down. Tried really hard the third time. But then by the fifth time, kind of said, heck with it. So here's a kid who's proficient that we're going to get measuring it. So I think there's some issues with that. And so the second point on that bill, and I know it's because it's going to be coming to all of us, well, there's a lot put on your department, and I think too much, frankly. And I think we need to look at that and amend it as it goes through. But those are a couple comments. Interesting, we're going to use data from that test. But okay, thanks. That's would you agree, Senator Nicholas? That's my question. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Superintendent Hill, I've actually never really got a clear picture of how much money we actually spend on PAWS. That's the question.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Esquivel, it's approximately $9 million a year.
Well, Mr. Chairman, follow up on that. Is it, now you were talking about timing it down to 3 weeks, timing down to 4 weeks?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, opening up the window to 4 weeks. It had been 4 weeks. It had been reduced to 3 weeks in December that was being imposed, and I intervened and reopened it back to 4 weeks after speaking with schools around the state and listening to their concerns about it being a tighter window.
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman and Superintendent Hill, you can do all that with the same amount of money? Would it cost more money to do 4 weeks?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, it all is within our contract. It doesn't cost us any more to do it within four.
Okay, thank you, ma'am.
Mr. Chairman, this question, I think Mr. Hansen probably answered this. You're the money man, aren't you? I guess, so the $9 million for the pause, and then it takes probably over that four-week window. I think what Ms. Representative Esquivel is getting at, how many days, classroom days? Is it about 4 days of testing when you add it all up? Four? Somebody know. Okay, say it's three or four. But let me ask you this. What do we spend per day educating kids in Wyoming? It's about $20 million a day, isn't it? Or what is it? Does somebody have that number to Sandy? Maybe Mr. Wilmarth back here might have that. And I guess so that – go ahead. What's our daily burn rate?
Mr. Chairman, Fred Hansen, Department of Education. President Harshman, that's the first time that question has ever been asked.
Can't be.
So,
old football coach from Casper's got to –
it's
come
a
on.
Billion. We spend, I believe
– 3 billion.
It's $1.3 billion.
Not counting so local resources.
175 days of instruction.
Local resources, too. Okay, go ahead.
There's 175 days of instruction. Divide 175 into 1.3 billion. And there's your daily rate.
Got it. But that doesn't count local resources.
No, the 1.3 is everything. 1.3 billion is the total guarantee
for everything.
For the year.
Okay. So I guess the true cost of this test is not just $9 million, and that's what I'm getting at. I mean, when we take away the instruction time to administer it and you take 2-3 days of it at $20 million a whack, you know, it's a pretty expensive test. And that's the point I want to make to the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Harshman, it takes 20 hours to test. 20 hours.
20, even for elementary, Mr. Chairman?
Is it?
It's an approximation when you're starting to look at all the content areas. Our understanding is it takes about 20 hours overall.
So a youngster's in school 7 hours a day, so 3 days. 7.5 million. So, Mr. Chairman, 7.5 million a day, so about 21 million on the nine. So it's 30 million a year we're spending. Thank you.
Like the testimony of the experts this summer is that it shouldn't take that long to accomplish what we need to do through a summative exam. That's part of what the setting up a committee to get out there. All right. Any other questions on pause?
Mr. Co-Chairman, I think what possibly would help, too, for the committee is just to know the total investment in pause since its inception. We've had some figures on that. I think that possibly the department can provide us with that. Or
sure. Just go ahead and do
that. Yeah, we don't need that now. That is something for later. But I think that would help the committee, too, just to understand the investment that we've made in education to this point on it.
Well, there's a lot of testimony on the pause throughout the summer on the recalibration committee that I don't think anybody believes from that committee that you don't need a summative exam, whether it looks like pause or whether it gets modified. That's what this bill process is.
With next item on is the transfer of employees. You have employees in Riverton and Laramie, and you've now expressed plans to, apparently, to shut down some offices.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
What are your plans with respect to that department?
At this time, the Riverton office will stay open. Those folks are centrally located, and they are primarily outreach. They go to all four corners of the state, and they travel about 250,000 miles a year, and it would increase, if they're in Cheyenne, to probably 700 to 800,000. I've checked.
You say at this time, I mean, do you plan to change that between now and the time that you prepare your next budget?
I do not foresee that. Mr. Chairman, I at 42 cents a square foot at that office, and the work that they're doing, I imagine them maintaining that office as far as I can see.
And that takes us to Laramie.
Mr. Chairman, I do plan on moving the Laramie office to Cheyenne. That move will better facilitate the communication with my assessment team, and I believe that the folks over there will benefit by working alongside them every day. One of the issues that I learned when I checked to see what the lease of that agreement, 90-day lease is what I found, and then we also learned that it was $138,000 a year.
Well, let's talk about the lease amount.
Okay. Okay.
If we want to save money in government, we mm-hmm. can move all the Casper offices to Cheyenne tomorrow. I'm quite certain we would save money. We could move all the Cody offices. And I don't think anybody's ever expressed a concern over $130,000 lease to have offices spread out the state. I don't remember. We've been through a lot of budgets. But if it's simply the issue that you can consolidate in Cheyenne, I have no doubt that we can consolidate a lot of offices and save money by bringing them to Cheyenne, but we wouldn't do that.
Mr. Chairman, at this point, I think it's in the best interest of my department and the work that we're doing for the children to be working alongside those two teams. Mr. Chairman, there are 29 employees.
They live in Laramie and they have families there.
Mr. Chairman, by and large, they do, and that's why, with the 90-day lease, I've considered extending it until the school year has completed.
Well, I mean, so they either quit or they travel 2 hours every day to come to work, and we've put a lot of resources into methods to communicate. We have state-of-the-art telecommunicating. I mean, your intention is to have 29 families move or travel to Cheyenne every day.
Mr. Chairman, my intention is to make certain that we're working the most efficiently and effectively on behalf of our students, and that has not been happening in the way that I can imagine it optimally be happening with that unit, and I know that this would be in the best interest of my goal. So, yes, I do.
Next item is the federal funding. What are your plans with respect to, is there any part of the budget that you don't intend to, that has federal funds allocated that you don't intend to accept?
Mr. Chairman, not at this time. I have asked my staff to imagine what it would look like without federal funds so that when those questions are asked of us, we know exactly what that entails. There are a great deal of regulatory issues that would come with not accepting federal funds, and I want us to be well informed as to what that means. That question has occurred in several forums, and so I've spoken with my staff about making certain that we're well informed as to the reality of what that means to us and to our kids. So I believe that that question was an important one to ask, and I did ask that, and we are working on that currently so that we can answer those questions thoughtfully.
Well, Matt, with respect to the budget, are there any federal funds that are appropriated in the budget that you know that are not going to continue through the biennium?
Mr. Chairman, no.
So I what's the purpose of the exercise if these budgets are appropriated, they're authorized for the biennium?
Mr. Chairman, I'm responding to questions of the people of Wyoming and legislators that I've spoken with about what that would mean not to take federal funding, and I'm asking my staff to imagine what that would look like so that we know exactly what that would mean as far as the regulations involved and what that would mean to our department and to our kids.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Hill, I guess the question on federal funding, could you look into it to see whether what's all or nothing, whether you know, we can opt out of some programs, what those different programs might be, kind of give us a summary of that when that information is available?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, I'd be happy to do that. This is quite complex, and it's going to take some time. And I'd be happy to share those results as soon as we have those.
Mr. Chairman, and I know just for the committee's edification that some of those numbers, Senator Meyer, have been floating around on the House side. I know I saw a handout. It may not have gone to the whole body yet, but because I know that there are other members on the House side that have been asking those questions, so we already have some numbers flying around on the House side.
Well, I think, though, right now there's about $110 million worth of federal funds that are appropriated through the budget. I guess the issue there is until such time as the budgets change, it's our expectation that those dollars will be utilized, the federal programs complied with. I mean, does anybody have any issue with that? I mean, it's
Mr. Chairman, it's $120 million, and it's 6% of our budget, 6.2% of our budget. With me is Christine Steele, and Christine is our federal programs director, and I would like to defer with your permission to Christine for follow-up questions.
Mr. Chairman, yes, the federal funds are approximately $120 million a year. Those funds are used for targeted populations of students that need additional educational support as opposed to any type of block grant funding. They have specific audiences of students that they are targeted for. It is about 6% of our budget, and provides various educational support throughout all the 48 districts.
I saw something on education, and I think that maybe these were biennium figures, but it was just the Title I and Title 19 or something like that. There was one at $72 million, another one at $50 million. Are those biennial figures then?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Meyer, yes, in the biennial budget, we have approximately $250 million for the programs. And so it's about $125 million a year.
And I'm sure, Ms. Steele, that you've taken into consideration the food service, and is that included in that for schools? And would it be affected should we be turning it down at the state level?
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Von Flayton, I have been in communication with the U.S. Department of Education along with Superintendent Hill. In the past, there has been, and I confirm that today, there has been no state that has ever turned down funds under the Elementary and Education Secondary Act. However, some states have inquired as to how that would look. The answer is yes. It is possible to turn down some of the funds. However, depending on which programs or titles are involved, there are other they are interrelated, so there would be some consideration and perhaps some impact study needed as to you know what it would mean if you decided that one program would be kept and not another. Yes, it is possible to turn down programs and keep nutrition, yes.
I think Utah did this when No Child Left Behind first came out. I believe they even voted on it, but I don't remember if they implemented it or they implemented a year and then gave up on the concept. I don't remember exactly.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Van Flayton, you are correct. Utah was one of the states that in 2004 and 2005 period of time wrote letters to the U.S. Department of Ed and asked what would the impact be. We have copies of at least one of the responses. Although Utah considered it, they did not decide to not participate, they did. They still participated in the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. And Colorado was another state that inquired into it. And that same period of time, more as to what would happen if the districts decided to turn down certain programs while the state participated. So there are different nuances in some of the past. But you are correct. It was Utah.
I just would say, in my short memory here, last 6 or 8 months, we did have a presentation on this. Ed Committee, I think within maybe not this interim, the interim before, but we did have this presentation by the department, and they went over the major components and talked about it phasing down. Even if you stop doing parts of it, you wouldn't lose it all in that next year. So I don't know if you can dig up that presentation, but it was pretty comprehensive.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Von Flayton, I certainly will check into that for you. I don't have the study in front of me, but we could check that out and provide you information on that.
Matt?
Mr. Chairman, we have the federal fund information that was provided to the Select Committee on School Finance Recalibration that can sure provide this committee on all the title funding as well as the biennial funding for the federal funds. And I also, just to follow up, we provided a memo, I think the past couple of days, on the federal funds to this committee that showed a look at the title federal programs that were tied to No Child Left Behind.
Other questions? Next item is the PTSB, the data. My recollection is we were told we would carry on two positions, carry over from recalibration to carry on that effort. Is that going to happen?
Mr. Chairman, with me is again Laurel Ballard, and I'd like to defer to Laurel for the answers.
Yes, please, Mr. Chairman. We just to make sure that all the committee knows, we've been working with the Recalibration Select Committee on the labor market study, and in that ran across, had to pull some data from the Professional Teaching and Standards Board, of which then we found all of their records, or a majority of their records, in paper format filed by first name in their records. Kind of when you walk into their records room, it's like going into a medical office, and you just kind of go, you know, twirl through all the records till you find the right one. We spent many hours working with both temporary staff and consultant staff on getting all of the teacher record information in terms of their educational record information and put into an electronic format that could be used for the labor market study that the committee had requested. We, in that discussion, came across the committee has put forward, I believe in the school finance bill, the moving of the PTSB data into the Department of Ed's database, into our longitudinal data system. And the answer is yes, we are still intending to do that. And the answer, and you're asking about the positions, is yes, my staff, and especially my database and data analysis staff, are at full capacity. That what we're asking for is the AWAC positions that were temporary to stay. And right now they are set, the two AWAC positions are set to end on June 30th of 2011. And so it's really the continuation of those staff members.
That's in one of the bills that's pending?
It's the fiscal note to the public finance bill, I believe. Whichever bill the PTSB data is in, which I think that's where it is.
All right. What about the issue of data? We've engaged a lot of data keeping to make sure that we're getting all of our school district stuff. Are we going to see any changes in the data keeping and what we're getting?
We are, Mr. Chairman, we are continuing with the data that we were collecting then to make sure that when school finance and recalibration comes through again, that we continue to have all the data, and it's not a mass, it's not a large request at the end of 5 years or 4 years for the school. So we are continuing with that. We are looking at how to move from some of the really large data collections that we have to ask the districts for 3 times a year. To start pulling some of that information through what we call an event-based reporting. So when they make changes in their, let's say, the student information systems, that's reported to, can be reported to the state immediately. So I believe Superintendent Hill talked about like the 1,400 errors and things like that. Districts are not getting large volumes of errors at once and having to spend lots of time going back, figuring out what secretaries or whoever had put in many months before, that they're looking at. We're looking at how to have that collection so that it's more immediate and the errors are corrected and much more on a much more real-time basis, which then we have, if we can start getting information on a more real-time basis, we can provide a lot more services to the districts and things like that that become much more meaningful because the data is collected much quicker.
Any data that you're collecting that we've asked for that you're not going to collect?
None that I know of, okay. Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? If not, I think we've got a 7 o'clock meeting and some of us to attend to. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Later and I have to move out a little.